You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
It doesn't sound to me like Israel and the Islamic State are at loggerheads. As a matter of fact, we know that jihadists injured in battle in southern Syria have been transported over the Israeli border to be tended to at Israeli hospitals. There was a case in northern Israel where a bag fell off of a pickup truck. It was heading towards Syria, and a local farmer looked inside the bag, and inside were brand new black and white Islamic State flags. We also know that Israeli intelligence has been working with these jihadist groups, not only inside Syria, but also inside Iraq.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Wayne Madsen. Today's show, Langley's Jihadists, from the Mujahideen to ISIL. Wayne Madsen is a Washington, D.C. based investigative journalist, author, and columnist. He has written for numerous magazines, and his columns have appeared in the Miami Herald, Houston Chronicle, Philadelphia Inquirer, Columbus Dispatch, Sacramento Bee, and Atlantic Journal Constitution, among others. He is the author of The Handbook of Personal Data Protection, Genocide and Covert Operations in Africa, 1993 to 1999. Co-author of America's Nightmare, The Presidency of George Bush II. Jaded Tasks, Big Oil, Black Ops, and Brass Plates. The Manufacturing of a President, The CIA's Insertion of Barack H. Obama Jr. into the White House. L'Affaire Petraeus, and National Security Agency Surveillance, Reflections and Revelations. Madsen has been a regular contributor on RT and Press TV, and a frequent political and national security commentator on Fox News and many other network news channels. He is the online editor of WayneMadsenReport.com, whose investigative journalism motto is Comfort the Afflicted and Afflict the Comfortable. Today we discuss his essay, Born of the USA, The Real Origins of ISIL, which is included in the anthology, ISIS is Us, The Shocking Truth Behind the Army of Terror. Wayne Madsen, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Your essay, Born of the USA, The Real Origins of ISIL, is included in the book, ISIS is Us, The Shocking Truth Behind the Army of Terror. You begin with what retired director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, revealed about the creation of ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. What did Michael Flynn have to say about ISIL's origins?
Well, Michael Flynn, and of course, right now, Michael Flynn has a host of other problems. And it was, you know, I mean, he's not, not everything Michael Flynn has advocated, I would certainly advocate, but he had like a broken clock, is correct twice a day. And so was Flynn when he basically, in a, Defense Intelligence Agency assessment said, look, the people who are funding, ISIL in Syria and Iraq are groups supported by the United States. He actually went back and looked at what prompted the rise of ISIL, and it was Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and her friend George Soros's ill-advised Arab Spring, which saw the overthrow of governments in Libya, Syria, Yemen, and Tunisia, and for a short time we had the Muslim Brotherhood running Egypt. And that series of events, where we saw the rise of these jihadist groups financed by the Saudis. And we just saw once again, an American president throwing his lot in with the most extreme radical form of Islam on the planet, which is Wahhabism. We saw it on in stark display with President Trump doing the sword dance, just as George W. Bush did with the Saudi royal family, the men only, I would add. This is the problem with U.S. policy in the Middle East. And Flynn's assessment was correct. He said, look, it's the United States that is now trying to isolate the Syrian government, which we call the regime, not the, you know, the recognized government of Syria. And he said this is a danger to our interests. Now, later on, of course, Flynn was caught after he retired, accepting money from the Erdogan government of Turkey. And ISIL had no greater, other than the Saudis and the Qataris and Emiratis, ISIL had no greater friend than Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey. Turkish officials were reselling Syrian and Iraqi oil on behalf of ISIL, with all the proceeds going into the ISIL coffers. Again, Flynn saw that initial support for these jihadist groups after the fall of Gaddafi, Mubarak, Ben Ali in Tunisia, and President Saleh in Yemen, and the almost overthrow of Bashar Assad in Syria. This is what directly led to the problems, not only in the Middle East, but what happened when ISIL began funding terrorist attacks in Europe, the United States, and other countries. But the situation with Manchester, once again, is very interesting, because the perpetrator, who apparently was a suicide bomber, was the case in France and Belgium and Germany, known to the authorities beforehand. Why did they allow these people to continue with their networking amongst the jihadist groups to pull off this particular attack?
Is ISIL an outgrowth of Al-Qaeda in Iraq? And who was the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq?
Well, ISIL is an outgrowth of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Al-Qaeda, which was run by Osama bin Laden, in turn was an outgrowth of the Arab Legion. The CIA arranged to have go fight the Soviet Union during the Mujahideen War in Afghanistan. So the CIA has been closely connected to the grandfather of ISIS, which were the Arab Legion, of which Osama bin Laden was one of the jihadist leaders fighting in Afghanistan. In Iraq, there were several leaders who claimed to wear the mantle of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, later the Islamic State. But it's not certain that any of these individuals actually really existed. Zarqawi was the first guy who said he was the head of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. But there's been U.S. military officers have been quoted claiming that Zarqawi was a construct of U.S. intelligence, that he never really existed. And this was done as a way to garner support from the Sunni tribes in Iraq, because as we know, after the U.S. overthrew Saddam Hussein, which wasn't a wise decision either, since Saddam was able to keep these jihadists at bay. He was certainly not a jihadist himself. He was a Muslim, but his three favorite things were smoking Cuban cigars, listening to Frank Sinatra, and drinking Johnny Walker Red Label whiskey. You know, he's more like the Saudi jihadist in that respect, the Wahhabist royal family, where alcohol is banned, but they all get drunk behind their palace walls. But it's not clear whether there actually was a real Al-Qaeda in Iraq or whether it was just a bogeyman that was set up by U.S. intelligence as a threat to legitimize our continued presence in that country.
Well, as you point out in your essay that's included in this book, ISIS is Us, you go through the whole history of al-Zarqawi, how he was supposedly born in Jordan, etc. Then he became a member of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. Then we find him in Iraq. You mention in your article al-Zarqawi's involvement in the 2005 bombings in Amman, Jordan, of the Radisson SAS Hotel, the Grand Hyatt, and the Days Inn. I remember those attacks as I produced shows on those bombings. That was a long time ago. And then, do you have any recollection of how many times al-Zarqawi, that the government has claimed to have killed him or that he's died?
Oh, countless times. There were always news reports. I mean, it gets to the point where, and it's not just al-Qaeda in Iraq and Zarqawi. How many times have we heard the U.S. has taken out the number two of the Islamic State and such a location with precision guided munitions? There's no proof we ever killed any of these Islamic State people or Al Qaeda people, but there's plenty of proof that our so-called precision guided munitions have killed an awful lot of civilians, including women and children, as collateral damage. So I would argue that when the Pentagon talks about its precision guided munitions, they aren't that precision guided. But you know, Al-Qaeda and all of its and all its franchises in the Arabian Peninsula, North Africa, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and elsewhere, it's a very convenient organization that, you know, the U.S. and its allies can use not only to maintain this forward presence in Muslim and Arab countries, but also to justify these draconian surveillance states that have been implemented by people like George W. Bush and Barack Obama and Theresa May and David Cameron and Hollande, and I assume Macron, who's even more of a Wall Street creature than his predecessor in France, and Merkel in Germany. This bogeyman of Islamic State, al-Qaeda, so forth and so on, is what gives them justification for a lot of their actions.
Now, also with regard to Zarqawi, the beheading some time ago, I guess in 2004, the beheading of Nicholas Berg was supposedly done by Zarqawi. And as you point out in your article, a video found on the internet and released by Rita Katz of Sight was this video. What do we know about Rita Katz and Sight?
Rita Katz, she once was a consultant to the U.S. Treasury Department in their operation called GreenQuest, which was an operation to identify flows of money to jihadist radical Muslim organizations in the Middle East from U.S. Sources. And it sort of got out of hand. Apparently, the Treasury Department and the FBI in particular was not happy with her performance. I was told that the FBI saw her as a security threat. First of all, because she also has a relationship with Israeli intelligence, the Mossad. The group site, Search for International Terrorist Entities, itself was started by people affiliated with Mossad. Rita Katz is her family, they were Baghdadi Jews from Baghdad in Iraq. Her father was hanged by Saddam Hussein for being an Israeli spy. She and the rest of her family were able to escape to Israel, but we have an individual in Rita Katz, who I believe is her so-called intelligence surfing various websites. And we don't know who runs these websites, but when she's the first to grab videos and communiques, and just like with the Manchester bombing, she was the first to come out with the Islamic State communique claiming responsibility for the attack. It works too good. She's always the first to turn her site, which is called site. I'm very dubious. Anecdotally, I know that in the Washington area, and I got this from an Israeli who actually is a social, not a friend, but a social colleague of hers, that Rita Katz, she will not patronize a Washington area gas station or convenience store if she knows that it's owned or operated by Arabs. And it doesn't matter whether Arab Americans or not. I take anything that comes out of that site group, site intelligence, with not a grain but a boulder of salt. I don't believe anything they say, unless you want to believe in Israeli propaganda.
Who is the leader of ISIL, and what do we know about him? Now, you write in your article that there are two al-Baghdadis, Omar and Abu Bakr. What do we know about them?
Well, Omar didn't last too long either. He was Islamic State, said to have been out of Iraq. There were several reports that he, too, was a construct of U.S. intelligence. So they had to rebrand al-Baghdadi 1, and they came up with al-Baghdadi 2. And this is the guy who claims he's the caliph of the Islamic State, which claims territory from Western China to Spain. The group apparently has some thought that it's going to reclaim the entire Iberian Peninsula for the caliphate, as was the case during the Moorish control of the peninsula. This Baghdadi, he's always issuing communiques. There's been various reports he's been severely injured in U.S. attacks. There have been even a few reports that he's dead. But here we go with another person, who we don't even know if this is an actual individual or, again, another one of these CIA constructs. We do know that a few years ago, after the Syrian rebellion, Senator John McCain crossed the Turkish border into jihadist-occupied territory in Syria, and he was photographed with a guy who was claimed to by many people in Syria to be Baghdadi. And of course, McCain later denied that he met with Baghdadi. But McCain, as we know, he's the perfect senator to be taken in by this sort of psychological warfare operation. He has a predisposed hatred for Russia. He has this affinity for the Saudis and Saudi-backed groups, whether they're the jihadist rebels in Libya or in Syria or in Yemen. I think with John McCain, we also have a person who's senile. People of Arizona last year reelected this guy to a 6-year term. But he sounds good on TV. So if you're running a psychological warfare operation, McCain is great to just repeat all the talking points, that Assad has to go. The people of Syria deserve better. When he talks about the people of Syria, he's talking about jihadist groups. They will be the ones that take over in Syria, just like they were the ones who took over from Gaddafi in Libya, and we saw a bloodbath carried out there. The Salafists sat back as cops in Egypt were massacred under the Mohamed Morsi government, and then that government was used as a justification for the military to step in. We have General Assisi in charge of Egypt today, who is getting along very well with Donald Trump, just like the Saudis are, because Donald Trump basically said in Riyadh at the summit that the United States doesn't care about human rights. that these jihadist regimes are free to do whatever they want. And the Bahraini regime, which is a minority Sunni Wahhabist regime in that country, was the first to act upon Trump's rhetoric, and they stormed the village of the Shia leader of Bahrain. The Shias are a majority of that in that country, and killed at least one person. So while there was this massacre in Manchester at the Manchester Arena, there was also a Wahhabist attack sanctioned by the United States against the Shias of Bahrain.
I'm speaking with investigative journalist, author, and columnist Wayne Madsen. Today's show, Langley's Jihadists from the Mujahideen to ISIL. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I'm coming to you today to ask for your support for listener-sponsored, non-commercial KPFA Radio. KPFA Radio that carries Guns and Butter every Wednesday from 1 to 2 p.m. Today I am actually delighted to be able to offer a really good book as a thank you gift for a $75 donation to KPFA. This book is called ISIS is Us, The Shocking Truth Behind the Army of Terror. And I have been speaking with Wayne Madsen, who has contributed to this book. It's actually an incredible anthology all about the Middle East, the wars, the jihadis. There's some incredible writers in this book, and it's a really good place to start. And very easy to read, too, and lovely production and pictures. $75 to KPFA. Please give us a call right now. I'd love to get a few of you on the phone at 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Or you can pledge securely online at kpfa.org. Our thank you gift today on Guns and Butter, this incredible anthology, ISIS is Us, The Shocking Truth Behind the Army of Terror. And let me tell you just a few of the incredible researchers and journalists that have contributed to ISIS is Us. Unmasking ISIS by George Washington's blog. Now, that's a terrific blog on the internet. I think a lot of people are familiar with George Washington's blog, so you get his analysis. Born of the USA by Wayne Madsen, whom I've been speaking with today. I spoke with him yesterday. The Truth About ISIS by Syrian Girl Partisan. She runs quite a popular blog on the internet. It's the Military Monetary Media Complex. That's by John Paul Leonard. He actually publishes this book. He's the head of Progressive Press. Then there are citations from Michelle Chosadovsky, Webster Griffin Tarpley, Jonathan Mowat, F. William Engdahl, Thierry Masson, Vladimir Putin, Tony Carlucci, Ken O'Keefe, Seymour Hersh, Chris Brennan, The Saker, Deepak Kunar, Tim Anderson, and many other thinkers and researchers of our time. That's all included in ISIS is Us, The Shocking Truth Behind the Army of Terror. And you may have noticed, if you are a regular Guns and Butter listener, that a lot of the names that I just read off of you've heard on this show. If you listen every week, these are some incredible minds. ISIS is Us, The Shocking Truth Behind the Army of Terror, an incredible anthology on the Middle East wars. Our thank you gift to you today for a pledge to KPFA of $75. That's a tax-deductible contribution. The pledge line, and people are waiting for your call. I'm just hoping that several of you will step up to the phone and call us and donate to KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org. I hope you're enjoying today's show. I'm going to play as much of the audio that I recorded with Wayne Matthew that I can, but we do need your pledges. We need your support. Let me read you a little bit about this book. Ever wonder why we are losing the war on terror? Or how Russia took out more ISIS targets in 2 days than the U.S. coalition did in 2 years? Then this is the book for you. ISIS is Us tells what's really behind the rise of ISIS. Why the mess in the Middle East is no failure. It's the result of a, quote, divide and chaos policy. A panel of authors tells the incredible story with impeccable references, strategy, motive, historical background. It's all here. You'll see why the wars on Iraq, Libya, and Syria were not for democracy, but to break them into quarreling mini-states, divide and rule. Read about how the U.S. occupation in Iraq set up Sunni and Shiite death squads to carry out ethnic cleansing campaigns, like Nicaragua in the 1980s. ISIS was born from these terror brigades. First, ISIS was sent to topple Gaddafi in Libya. Fake stories of regime massacres were used to get airstrikes to win the war for Al-Qaeda. In Syria, mercenaries and snipers carried out random killings, which the U.S. embedded media pinned on Assad, trying to get another UN green light for a NATO bombing campaign. And last but not least, who gains from the war? An absolutely eye-opening book, ISIS is Us, The Shocking Truth Behind the Army of Terror. I'd love a lot of you to get this book. It's very informative, very easy to read. There's a heck of a lot in here. ISIS is Us, The Shocking Truth Behind the Army of Terror, for a $75 donation to KPFA today on Guns and Butter. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, or securely online at kpfa.org. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Of course, this is Guns and Butter, and I'm just hoping that we can get some people to support our non-commercial, listener-supported station, KPFA. I've been speaking with investigative journalist, author, and columnist Wayne Madsen, and I hope you're enjoying the show. I want to get a couple more people on the phone, then I want to go right back to a little bit more of the material that Wayne talks about. Wayne Madsen is very, very well informed about the Middle East. He knows a lot of history. He's written some incredible books, and one of them is a real classic that I actually happen to have, and I'm going to have him on the show on this book. It's called Genocide and Covert Operations in Africa, 1993 to 1999. It is an incredible book, and he is really an incredible investigative reporter. That's the book, ISIS is Us, The Shocking Truth Behind the Army of Terror, 1-800-439-5732. I'd like to get back to hear a little bit more of what Wayne Madsen has to say. How about let's listen to track 4.
Of course, and you describe Prince Bandar bin Sultan, also known as Bandar Bush, as the godfather behind the creation of ISIL. You also write that the House of Saud was the major bankroller of ISIL, and that Qatar mainly funds al-Nusra, and that both groups work together. It was in the news that during the Iraqi liberation of Mosul, they were finding European, U.S., and American armaments left behind.
Oh, absolutely. The Saudis were buying weapons on the open market, and they were being delivered, for example, to the jihadists in Benghazi. Some of Gaddafi's arms caches, which when I was in Libya during the NATO attack, they were very concerned about what was going to happen to these, especially the areas that the UN designated as stockpiles for chemical weapons, not to fall into the hands of these jihadists. And sure enough, that pipeline started from, you know, these arms warehouses, and the arms were being sent to Turkey, Erdogan's Turkey, where they were then being delivered to the jihadists in Syria. That whole issue with the Benghazi attack, nobody ever, really, very few people got that Ambassador Stevens was not really an ambassador. He was a State Department arms broker who was brokering the transfer of weapons from the former stockpiles of Gaddafi through Turkey to the Syrian jihadist rebels. And it was a deal that turned bad. You know, when you're in the mercenary and arms smuggling business, bad things could happen. And I was one of the few that, you know, with all this adulation, oh, they killed an American ambassador. Okay, he had the title of ambassador, but he was an arms smuggler. You know, my sympathy springs can't be pulled too much for people like that, because I know who the ultimate victims are going to be.
Well, how do you explain his murder?
Well, I think what happened is, you know, you're dealing with jihadist rebels who are controlling Benghazi, who have their hands on some of these former Gaddafi regime warehouses, arms caches, arsenals, and you're trying to work a deal out with them, because the last person Stevens met before that compound was stormed was the Turkish envoy in Libya. And it's quite clear what was being arranged here. It was an arms deal that went bad. You know, you see these, you know, Hollywood movies where somebody goes in and they're trying to work out an arms deal with some unsavory group, but, you know, the brokers, you know, whether it's a bunch of narco terrorists in Colombia, the brokers are the ones who get killed. And that's exactly what happened here. Somebody either didn't pay enough money, or looked at somebody the wrong way, or gave somebody the wrong kind of signal. And, you know, the CIA weapons depot in Benghazi was stormed and these Americans were killed.
Yes, that Benghazi events were always presented as so complicated in a way that would obfuscate what was actually going on there. So I think there's an enormous amount of confusion about that.
Yeah, I think there was a combination of events that also led up to it. And it wasn't just the arms deal that went bad. Why did it go bad? Well, you know, we saw the Obama administration all over the map. You know, there was this movie trailer that came out that was very insulting towards Islam. But we have to remember that this occurred. The attack on Benghazi, the U.S. facility in Benghazi, was on September 11th, 2012. And I still feel that the CIA, then run by David Petraeus, an arch neocon, you don't get any more neocon than Petraeus, and the people in the Romney campaign were trying to arrange for a hostage situation, and it could have been any number of U.S. embassies in the area. There were demonstrations in Cairo where they tried to get into the U.S. embassy there. It didn't work. There was another one in Sana'a in Yemen. That didn't work. But where was there a successful attack? It was on the facility in Benghazi, which wasn't really a consulate or embassy. I mean, they weren't issuing visas to Libyans to visit the United States to go to Disney World. It was also an arms transfer operation. And I think that's the security was not what it should have been. The CIA was trying to deal with the very same people who attacked it. And the rest, as I say, is history. And, you know, the very next day after Obama was elected president in November, the very next day, General Petraeus was relieved of his duties as a CIA director.
Yes, and thank you, Wayne, for reminding me that Benghazi killing took place on September 11th. I forgot that. That's very significant.
Yeah, what would have been better for the Romney campaign than to go into October with an October surprise. You know, he was quoted as saying, Mitt Romney, that, you know, maybe we could, we'll have an October surprise, except it didn't work out. It didn't work out that way. But can you imagine if U.S., if Stevens and other Americans were being held hostage in Benghazi, how the Romney campaign would have played that, the media would have played that. We might even had Ted Koppel back on Nightline, you know, day 28, America held hostage. And that could have spelled one term for Barack Obama and a Romney administration.
Now that Russia, that the Russian Federation has entered the war in Syria, do you consider that a game changer? And how has the Russian involvement changed the uprising, I guess you could call it, in Syria?
Oh, I think the Russia's commitment to Syria, I think, has a lot to do with Syrian army successes on the battlefield. The issue is at some point in time, U.S. forces and their surrogates are going to be confronting Russian forces, Syrian army forces. We already saw some skirmish involving Iranian units inside Syria where the U.S. attacked them. It was the second such attack by the U.S. Against either Syrian forces or groups allied with the Syrian government. I just would hope that, you know, we have this defense secretary named Mad Dog Mattis. I mean, he doesn't like the nickname because it was a pejorative, because Mattis was known in Iraq and other places as somebody who did not value diplomacy over, you know, military muscle. Now he's viewed as one of the quote unquote more moderate members of the Trump cabinet. It's amazing. We can only hope, though, that you know, wiser heads prevail on all sides, because it sounds like NATO special forces are now pouring into Syria, and if there is an incident between NATO and Russia, I can see how people like John McCain and Mad Dog Mattis will be chomping at the bit to exact revenge on Russia or retaliate against Russia. And, you know, one attack, we already saw this Trump attack on that airfield where Russian planes involved in the assault on ISIS-held territory in Palmyra. Now, that killed Syrians. It could have easily killed Russians. Trump's right about one thing. Vladimir Putin still enjoys wide popularity as the president of Russia. If Putin had to get on television and explain that, you know, Russian forces were attacked by the United States and there were Russian casualties, I think most Russians would support a retaliatory strike on U.S. forces in the Middle East. And of course, just like, you know, we've seen in movies in the 60s and 70s and 80s, that could easily lead to a wider war, including a nuclear war.
Well, exactly. And I mean, this is a very, very dangerous situation that the world is in right now, wouldn't you say?
I think it's probably more dangerous than during the Cold War, because during the Cold War, I think there was almost like a reluctant acceptance by the United States and the Soviet Union that, you know, there's certain things, you know, neither side will do to, you know, irritate the other. And there were rules of engagement. Sometimes we saw them get out of hand. Sometimes a proxy like North Korea would grab a U.S. spy ship, or Soviet planes would shoot down a Soviet plane, or the United States would ram a Soviet submarine and sink it. Yeah, those things happen. But I think there was a reluctant, maybe even not reluctant, agreement by both sides not to let things get too far out of hand. And I think all bets are off now, because you know, we have, I don't think, first of all, we had, whether you liked Lyndon Johnson or JFK or Ike or Nixon or Ford or Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan. And as much as I hate to admit it, George H.W. Bush, you really had adults in charge. And statesmen in quotes. I mean, they knew statecraft. Some were better statesmen than others. And I think on the Soviet side, you had the same thing, whether it was Brezhnev, Khrushchev, Chernenko, and then Gorbachev. Nowadays, you know, we've got people like Mad Dog Mattis, who unlike many predecessors, was not a former general, retired general, now running the Defense Department, which usually was in the hands of a civilian or somebody with the civilian history. And then you've got, other players involved, the Steve Bannons and the Stephen Millers and the Jared Kushners. We don't know much about these people. They do not have experience in statecraft. Now, some people will say, oh, Mattis just talking about he's promoting the interests of the deep state. Well, we all know that the deep state exists and the crimes it's committed in the past. And that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about having level-headed people who understand, whether I agree with their policies or not is immaterial, but who understand how diplomacy is played and how statecraft is played. And I don't see a lot of that in the Trump administration.
I'm speaking with investigative journalist, author, and columnist Wayne Madsen. Today's show, Langley's Jihadists, from the Mujahideen to ISIL. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Today we're coming to you for your financial support for KPFA, for non-commercial radio, for programming that you're not going to hear on other stations. KPFA is very special in that regard. You're going to hear people on Guns and Butter and on other shows that you're not going to hear anywhere else. We don't have commercials. We depend upon your support to keep broadcasting. It's very expensive to run a real terrestrial radio station. It's not an internet podcast. This is a radio station. We've got a lot of expenses to cover, and we're hoping that you will call right now and support KPFA at 1-800-439-5732. We have a thank you gift today, an incredible anthology, really. It's a book I'd love to see a lot of people read, ISIS Is Us, The Shocking Truth Behind the Army of Terror. This is an anthology. There are many, many different writers and researchers included. You've been listening to the voice of Wayne Madsen. He has one section in the book. He's just one of very many contributors. I mentioned a few earlier. We've got George Washington's blog. We've got Wayne Madsen. We have Syrian Girl Partisan. We've got citations from Michelle Chosadovsky, Webster Griffin Tarpley, Jonathan Mowat, William Engdahl. Many of these you've heard on the air with me. Thierry Masson, Vladimir Putin, Tony Carlucci, Ken O'Keefe, Seymour Hersh, The Saker. I just did two incredibly wonderful shows with The Saker on Russia. I hope a few of you heard those. And on and on and on. An incredible book. I'd love people to pick this book up for a very reasonable donation of $75 by calling today at 1-800-439-5732. A $25 donation, of course, makes you a member of KPFA for an entire year. Those $25 donations are very important to us. 1-800-439-5732. ISIS Is Us, The Shocking Truth Behind the Army of Terror. This book has an amazing table of contents. It would probably take me 10 minutes just to read off the table of contents. But here's just a little bit of what is in the book. Who needs a clash of civilizations? Islamic fundamentalism fostered by U.S. foreign policy. Fall of the Arab Spring, NATO's Islamist extremist allies. A word on Wahhabism. Saudi tsunami of money to Pakistan for 24,000 madrasas. The Oded Yonon plan, Balkanization for Greater Israel. Map makers eagerly carving up the Middle East, Islamophobia, and empire. And that is just like maybe one-tenth of what is in this book that I would love to have you read, ISIS is Us, The Shocking Truth Behind the Army of Terror. That is our thank you gift today to those of you who can pledge a $75 financial donation to KPFA, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or securely online at kpfa.org. I'm not in the station today. I'd like to thank those of you who have stepped up to the phone, who have given a call, and made your support today to KPFA Fund Drive, and I know we're behind. So I'm hoping that several of you who have not donated this year or have not donated in this fund drive can do that right now. $75, 1-800-439-5732. ISIS is Us, The Shocking Truth Behind the Army of Terror. We have 11 minutes to go, and I'm hoping, you know, I think I'd like to play maybe three or four or five more minutes. Lucretia, how about let's play a little bit of track three.
You write that former CIA chief John O'Brien authorized the training of ISIL guerrillas at a secret base in Jordan's northern desert region and at another installation near the American air base at Incirlik in Turkey. Now, in the news, just in the last couple of days, there are military maneuvers going on in the desert in Iraq, near Jordan and Syria, and there's some sort, I think it's called Al Tanf. Yes.
Yeah.
What do you know about that? And I've also read that Russia has now put in special forces into that area as well, and that there are some sort of Iraqi fighters shooting at American planes that are flying over there.
Well, yeah. I mean, what we have is, you know, everybody, it seems, is in Syria now. The Syrian government, with Russian support, but also support of Iran, Hezbollah, has been able to turn the tide on these jihadist rebel forces. And they're, you know, the mere fact that there's now fighting in that tri-border area of Jordan, Syria, and Iraq is an indication that the Syrian army under, Assad is starting to reestablish control over its more remote borders, including that one. So, that of course is not welcome news to the CIA, which, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's under Brennan or this guy, guy Pompeo, nobody ever sees that the CIA's proxies are, you know, getting it handed to them on the battlefield. And now there's reports that NATO special forces are inside Syria. Now, that is the potential to really make this thing more international, to have Norwegian troops inside Syria, as one report was, just looking for some incident between Russian forces and NATO forces that could be used to, you know, start a wider conflict.
You've been listening to the voice of Wayne Madsen, whom I spoke with yesterday. Today's show, Langley's Jihadists from the Mujahideen to ISIL. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. We've got, what have we got? We've got a few minutes left until the top of the hour, and I'm urging those of you who are listening who haven't pledged yet to KPFA, particularly those of you who are regular listeners to KPFA, as well as those of you who have never pledged, now would be a good time to do it because the station really needs your support. A $75 tax-deductible contribution, we can send you this highly recommended book, ISIS is Us, The Shocking Truth Behind the Army of Terror. Please give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Or online at kpfa.org. You know, I mentioned a little earlier that one of the contributors to ISIS is us is a partisan Syria girl, Syrian girl. She has a very popular blog on the internet, and one of her articles in this book is called 8 Reasons Why the New World Order Hates Syria, and she makes 8 points. Number 1, Syria's central bank is state-owned. 2, Syria has no debt to the IMF. 3, Syria has no GMO. Syria has never had genetically modified food and has recently formalized this into law. Number 4, Syrians are aware of the global conspiracy. Number 5, Syria has gas and plans to build a pipeline. 6, Syria opposes Zionism and Israel. And 7, Syria is the last secular country in the Middle East. Just think about it. The last secular country in the Middle East, that is really scary. And Syria has been at war now for, what, 5-6 years? The whole place is being torn apart. Syria is an incredible country, and it's very incumbent upon us to understand exactly what is going on there. This is not a popular uprising. These jihadis were sent in from the outside. And for those of you who listen regularly to Guns and Butter, you may remember back in 2011, 2012, I spoke with 2 different people who had actually been in Syria when the violence started. Both Webster Tarpley and Michelle Chesedovsky were there on separate occasions. They each told me the same thing, that the violence started with snipers. Well, a popular uprising doesn't start with snipers. When you have snipers, well, the mention of snipers reminds me of Maidan Square in Kiev. These things are staged. The takedown of Syria is being orchestrated, and it's an absolute and total tragedy. And this is an incredible book. There's so much information in here about all of the wars in the Middle East. ISIS is Us, The Shocking Truth Behind the Army of Terror. This is our premium, our thank you gift to you today, who can support KPFA Radio, support Guns and Butter, support Wayne Madsen and the incredible work he does, Progressive Press that has published this book. Progressive Press publishes a lot of the books that have been written by people that you hear regularly on Guns and Butter. ISIS is Us, The Shocking Truth Behind the Army of Terror, a $75 pledge to KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. A $25 pledge makes you a member of KPFA for a year, and that also enables you to vote in the local station board elections. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. I'm a full-time volunteer. Yaro Mako and Tony Rango and I, we produce these shows. We bring them to you every week. It is so very important to support listener-sponsored, non-commercial radio. What you hear on this station is not what you're going to hear on other radio stations, which I'm sure you're fully aware of. 1-800-439-5732, $75. Give us that call or go to kpfa.org. There's so much in this book, it's kind of hard to know where to start. The ISIS-Contra affair, Ambassadors of Terror, how the CIA created ISIS, the Libyan connection, Syria's fake color revolution, what's the real story? America's closest allies in the Middle East support ISIS. Turkey supports ISIS. Israel supports ISIS. The U.S. supports ISIS. Born of the USA, the real origin of ISIL. Oh, I just got a message from Lucretia. Thank you. Joy in the phone room wanted to know if you can announce we need phone volunteers. So that's a lovely way to get involved in KPFA is to come on down to the station at 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. in KPFA. Get involved at the station. Meet some of the programmers. You can come down there right now. They need people to answer the phone. That's a lot of fun, too. And, you know, a lot of people started their career at KPFA by volunteering in the phone room. It's a great way to get involved. We need you to come down to the phone room at 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way in Berkeley, California. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I've got about a minute and a half. I'd love to get a few more of you on the phone, 1-800-439-5732, to pledge for ISIS Is Us, The Shocking Truth Behind the Army of Terror, a $75 donation. Your $75 donation goes so very far to keep KPFA on the air. You can always go to kpfa.org and pledge securely there. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. If you'd like to give me feedback, you can always send me an email at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. We are on Twitter now at G&B Radio, so I send out Twitter announcements of the content of upcoming shows. You can also go to gunsandbutter.org and listen to the archives of former shows. 1-800-439-5732. We've got less than a minute to go. I'd love to get maybe five more people to call and support KPFA, non-commercial, listener-sponsored radio. 1-800-5732. ISIS Is Us, The Shocking Truth Behind the Army of Terror, for your donation of $75. 1-800-439-5732. Thank you all so much for supporting KPFA. Now the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the...
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Thank you.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, some wise thoughts on capitalism, democracy, and ecology. It's looking like we can't have all three at once. We'll hear from Noam Chomsky, and also, if time permits, from Christian Sorensen. I hope you'll stay tuned. In the 1990s, all the media pundits were celebrating the triumph of neoliberal economic policy, deregulation, and capitalism in general. The Soviet Union had collapsed, communism had nearly vanished, socialism was in retreat, the United States was the world's sole great power, and neoliberal capitalism reigned supreme. The stock market was at a record high, corporate profits were at a record high, and pundit Francis Fukuyama was declaring the end of history. Utopia for one and all, apparently. The pundits failed to mention a couple of other facts. Working-class wages were declining. Industrial jobs were disappearing rapidly, and wealth was being concentrated at the top of the economic pyramid. Democracy in America has always been fairly weak, but now democracy was rapidly getting even weaker. At the time, a few shrewd critics did note that not all was well. The corporations and the rich may have been enjoying a golden age, but the outlook for the rest of us did not look so rosy. Noam Chomsky was one of the dissenting voices, and Chris Hedges, and Neil Postman, and journalist Barbara Ehrenreich. But of course, none of the dissenters got the slightest amount of airplay in the corporate-controlled media. The great crash that began in 2007 didn't surprise anybody who was paying attention. What did surprise many of us was how rapidly and how thoroughly the federal government plundered the U.S. Treasury, then gave trillions of our dollars to the private banking corporations so the banks and their shareholders wouldn't lose a dime on the crash that they caused. Meanwhile, the government did practically nothing to help the millions of citizens who were getting crushed in the crash. If this were a democracy, would this have happened? Would the government take $1 trillion from the working citizens and simply give it to people who were already indefensibly rich? Incidentally, the head of the government during this unprecedented giveaway was a Democrat. That champion of the little guy, Barack H. Obama. Well, the situation has gotten worse since then. Now we are facing not just the destruction of the American middle class, but the destruction of the ecosphere. But the same people are calling the shots, and they're calling the same shots. And the score looks like it's capitalism 2, democracy 0. And who even knew that capitalism and democracy were opposing teams? Well, it's becoming more apparent that they are. Noam Chomsky discusses the connections between capitalism, democracy, and the fate of life on Earth. This is from his recent long talk in Cambridge, Mass. On April 24, 2017. You'll recognize the lady asking the questions as Amy Goodman. Here they are.
Which takes us to your latest book, Requiem for the American Dream, where you talk about the 10 principles of the concentration of power and wealth, how it's happening, what to watch out for.
Well, credit for the 10 principles should go to the producers of the film. What they did was take a lot of interviews and discussions about all sorts of things and put them in a coherent and, I think, pretty effective form. You can look at the film and see, or the book, but my feeling is they did a really good job.
So the book is accompanying this film that is now out on Netflix. But you talk about, for example, Principle 1, reducing democracy, Principle 2, shaping ideology, and Principle 3, redesigning the economy.
Well, all of those fall together, and they're part of a pretty remarkable development that's taking place in, actually, in human history. Humans, in the last 60 or 70 years, have succeeded in creating a kind of a perfect storm, literally. Two major attacks on the prospects for survival: global warming, nuclear weapons, the Anthropocene, the nuclear age. And the third is a set of socioeconomic policies designed to undermine the possibility of dealing with the problems. The problems could be dealt with only in a functioning democracy of engaged, informed people who could make decisions, who would be informed and could make decisions to deal with the crises. But the so-called neoliberal programs of the past generation, designed to undermine the institutions, the governmental and popular institutions that might deal with these issues, all a unit. One result is a very significant decline in democracy. You can't carry out economic policies of the type that have been implemented in the past generation in a functioning democracy. That's impossible. Let me just take a look at the numbers. The neoliberal programs were basically taking off right around 1980. It escalated, started a little with the late Carter, escalated under Reagan, went on more under Clinton, and so on. 2007 was the peak of supposed success. This is right before the crash. A lot of euphoria among economists, political analysts about the great achievements of neoclassical economics, of the great moderation, the neoliberal programs, dismantling of regulations, all these great successes. 2007, what was happening to American working people at that time? In 2007, wages, real wages, were lower than they had been in 1979 when the experiment took off. In fact, for the majority of the population, it's a period of stagnation or decline. Benefits have declined. Some of the reasons were explained by Alan Greenspan, head of the Federal Reserve, who was in charge pretty much of managing the economy. He testified to Congress that part of the success of the economy, the low inflation and so on, was due to what he called growing worker insecurity. Working people were insecure. They were intimidated. They knew that they were in a dangerous situation, precarious situation. As a result, they didn't press for increase in wages and for decent wages and benefits. They were willing to accept effective decline in their living standards. And Greenspan, who was a close observer of the economy, pointed out that this continued even when jobs were increasing in the late Clinton period. It was deeply embedded in the nature of the policies being carried out that working people are intimidated. They're living precarious lives. Many of them are part-time. They're losing security. Their unions are being destroyed, and their wages are declining. So it's all great. The economy is wonderfully healthy. Can you carry out policies like that in a democracy? I mean, are people going to vote for it? Same in Europe, even worse in many ways. The so-called austerity programs, even the economists of the IMF, International Monetary Fund, their own economists report that these policies make no economic sense. But the IMF bureaucrats, the ones who are part of the decision-making apparatus, they vote for them. And the effect on Europe is the same thing. As far as democracy is concerned, just like in the United States, there's anger, contempt for, you know, for the major governing institutions. Here it's Congress, there it's the political parties. You just saw it in France yesterday. The two major parties are barely visible in the election, and it's happening all over Europe, same kind of thing that's happening here. I mean, here it's happening in a way which is almost farcical because of the kind of actions carried out by the leadership. In Europe, it's being pursued in a way which is really ominous. I mean, you don't have to look far back to find a time when fascist parties actually had power in Europe, and we know what happened. And now there are neo-fascist parties with fascist roots often, which are pretty close to power, even in places like Austria and Germany, which have some memories of it. France as well was a very pro-Nazi country, the Vichy government. It was rounding up Jews faster than the Germans wanted them. A really ugly record. And seeing these things come back, or just seeing a situation in which, according to recent polls, a majority of Europeans think there should be no more Muslims in Europe. I mean, that evokes some memories, not nice ones. You can't attribute it all to the neoliberal economic policies, but a lot of it does follow from that. When you impose on people circumstances of this kind, you have to make sure that they have no way of responding politically. In Europe, it's done pretty straightforwardly. The main decisions about socioeconomic policies are made by the so-called Troika, IMF, European Central Bank, and the European Commission, which is unelected. So three unelected bodies, they make the decisions. They do listen to voices, the voices of the northern banks, mostly German banks, and the people suffer. And they get they're angry, frightened, often reacting in dangerous ways. We see similar phenomena here. So to go back to the pincers movement, what's happened is we've created two huge threats to survival. We have systematically, not you and me, but the leadership has systematically created socioeconomic policies which have as a consequence, almost immediate consequence, the undermining of functioning democracy, the one thing that might deal with the disasters. Like I said, it's kind of perfect storm. Real credit to the human species to have contrived something like this.
Principle four is shift the burden onto the poor and the middle classes. Principle five, attack the solidarity of the people. Six, let special interests run the regulators. Seven, engineer election results. Eight, use fear and power of the state to keep the rabble in line.
Is it necessary to comment? I think you're all familiar with it.
Nine is manufacture consent, and principle 10 is marginalize the population.
Well, in fact, that's exactly what's happening. And there's a reason for it. You cannot carry out the kinds of policies that have been developed in the last generation and have the population function democratically. In Europe, you can't get people to vote for policies which are undermining their lives, which are leaving especially younger people without any hopes of decent employment, which are driving people to precarious existences, which are undermining wages, reducing benefits. In England, right now, undermining, threatening what had been the world's most effective and efficient national health system. You can't get people to vote for things like this. So what you have to do is marginalize them in one way or another, turn them against each other, turn their anger against vulnerable people. That's a standard technique. Don't look at the people who are really doing this to you. Look at the ones who are more vulnerable, immigrants, the poor, you know, Muslims, blacks, anybody. We're familiar with that, too. There's not a slight history about it. It's like an almost logical consequence of the socioeconomic policies which have been imposed and lauded, in fact, by elites, including liberal elites. A lot of this was done, let's say, by the Clinton administration. It was hell, the deregulation, for example, which very quickly led to one after another financial crisis. That was initiated by liberal economists who were telling us how wonderful it is. And there's actually a theory, a neoclassical economic theory, which says, yeah, it's fine. Actually, there were people who warned against it. There were people who knew a lot of left independent economists, but even people right out of the mainstream, like Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel laureate, back around 1995 or so, he wrote an article actually in a World Bank research journal in which he warned against what he called the religion that the market knows best. He says, that's the religion, as he put it, that's being followed by economists. And he says, you got to take a look at that religion. Like a lot of religions, it just doesn't work. Economic history and even logic show us lots of things that are wrong about it, but that was pursued with abandon on the basis of theories of efficient markets, rational behavior, rational expectations, and so on, none of which had any empirical basis or founding. The doctrines were accepted for the very simple reason that they were highly beneficial to wealth and power. And that makes them acceptable, and you get the results that you have. The undermining of the only means possible to try to deal with the existential crises that we have created. So again, it's a kind of perfect storm. Part all sorts of sources, including just socioeconomic policies of a bipartisan nature.
You talk about a perfect storm. Do you think fascism is rising in the United States?
I think there's a danger of fascism in Europe. You have to be a little bit careful about that. I mean, if you're a black kid in the ghetto, yeah, you can say it kind of looks like fascism. But for most of us, people like us, there aren't stormtroopers in the streets. There's no fascist political party. There's no ideology of fascism. The Trump ideology reduces to pretty much me, you know. That's not fascism, whatever you think it is. So there are serious dangers. But I think fascism, in a way, gives it too much credit. It makes it look like more of a well-formulated ideology than it actually is. I think what we're seeing are the desperate efforts to try to hold together rising disasters that for which the means have been undermined.
I've got 90,000 pounds in my pajamas. I've got 40,000 French francs in my fridge. I've got lots of lovely lira, now the Deutsche Mark's getting dearer, and my dollar bills would buy the Brooklyn Bridge. There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing quite as beautiful as cash. Some people say it's folly, but I'd rather have the lolly. With money you can make a splash. There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing like a newly minted pound. Everyone must hanker for the butchness of a banker. It's accountancy that waits the world around. You can keep your Marxist ways, but it's only just a phase. For it's money, money, money makes the world go round.
A little socioeconomic political commentary by Monty Python. And before that, one of America's finest thinkers on matters of current events and national policies, Professor Noam Chomsky. He is Professor Emeritus at MIT Department of Linguistics. Humorist Richard Armour, himself a Professor Emeritus, reminds us that emeritus means out of merit. Well, I think that Chomsky is not quite out yet. He still has considerable merit. Chomsky explained the perfect storm created by our capitalist economic system. The storm consists of 1. Global climate change, 2. Nuclear weapons, and 3. the undermining of democratic institutions that could deal with problems 1 and 2. For that lucid analysis, thank you again, Professor Emeritus Chomsky. Maybe I should explain. Professor Emeritus is an honorary title given to tenured college professors when they retire. Tenured professors are now a dying breed. Like other capitalist greedheads, university administrators prefer to hire low-wage, insecure, part-time contingent workers, hired semester to semester, to do as much of the teaching as possible. This is one of the great scandals of even our great universities. These contingent faculty are called part-time adjunct instructors. So far, there has been no part-time adjunct instructor emeritus, possibly because part-time adjunct instructors can never afford to retire. Usually, they're not eligible for a pension plan or any other benefit in any case. Welcome to the gig economy, my fellow PhDs. But I digress. Or do I? Enough of me. Let's hear from Christian Sorensen. His article was published at counterpunch.org on March 28, 2017. Sorensen does not talk about democracy, but, like Chomsky, he does focus on capitalism and its destruction of our environment. It's titled, "We've Let Capitalism Kill the Planet," by Christian Sorensen. Here goes. The headlines in the first 3 months of 2017 have made one thing clear. Capitalism is killing the planet. Capitalism, the governing structure of nearly every society on Earth, puts profit above all other considerations. The consumer cycle is indifferent to proper disposal or reprocessing of discarded natural resources because such actions do not maximize profit. Oceans suffer greatly. They cover over 70% of the Earth's surface. They are integral to the prosperity of all known life. Human-caused climate change is killing fish stocks and fundamentally changing marine ecosystems. Human activity is depleting oxygen in the oceans. Plastics are everywhere. Humans root roughly 150 million tons of plastic into the oceans each year. Microplastics from the likes of synthetic fabrics and vehicle tires choke ocean life. Approximately 46,000 pieces of discarded plastic of various sizes occupy any square mile of ocean. They work their way up the food chain. Extinctions are commonplace. Critical areas of land, including wetlands and forests, are vanishing at astonishing rates. Earth has lost roughly 10% of her wilderness since the 1990s. Humans threaten over 60% of the world's primates with extinction. Harsh agricultural practices, tourism, and construction are rapidly killing grasshoppers across Europe. And grasshoppers are a critical food source for many animals, including reptiles and birds. The middle class is going extinct as well. The world's richest 8 humans have as much money as the poorest half of the world's population. The richest 1% of the entire human population possesses as much wealth as the rest of humanity. These examples are just a drop in the bucket. These are not anomalies. Pollution is the capitalist routine. Pollution is profit. Raising forest for profit is humdrum. Extinction is progress. Asphyxiating Earth is good for big business. Capitalism, the maximization of profit at the expense of animal and planet, is a plague of our own creation. The planet will eventually recover after humanity is gone, or once humanity collectively agrees to prioritize the health of our only home. Humans are ill, and capitalism is our collective infection. It must end. That was Christian Sorensen. We've let capitalism kill the planet. I edited the text just a little bit for clarity over the radio. Thanks to Sorensen and to Counterpunch.org. And thanks again to Chuck Rosina for the Chomsky recording. Thanks also to the several non-profit community radio stations that broadcast New World Notes. For example, stations KPHD and KGIG-FM in Modesto, California, ably managed by Mr. Brad at Valley Media. Not to mention that beacon of light in darkest Idaho, KRFP-FM, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho. And closer to home, of course, WWUH-FM in West Hartford, Connecticut, coming out of the University of Hartford. And several other stations, too. Thank you. And, of course, thank you for listening to New World Notes. Find more of us at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum, wishing you a good week, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Catch you later.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. We'll be right back.
of truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear whistleblower Sybil Edmonds, who has been gagged and classified by the U.S. government, share her story as a translator at the FBI and what she learned there about who's behind terrorism. And what you're about to hear comes from an April 2016 interview with the radio show host Tom Woods. It's episode 629, and you can find it at his website, tomwoods.com. I've edited parts of it here to fit into a 30-minute show. Sybil Edmonds is editor and publisher of Boiling Frogs Post. She's founder and president of the National Whistleblowers Coalition, and she's also behind a new effort at independent media called NewsBud, which you can learn more about at her website, boilingfrogspost.com. And here she is, Sybil Edmonds.
I began my work with the FBI 4 days after September 11, 2001, after the September 11 terrorist attacks. And I served two functions for the FBI's Washington field office, both as language specialist translator for three languages, but also that's Turkish, Farsi, and Azerbaijani. But I also performed analysis because of my background, political background, and knowledge of these countries that were the targets of certain investigations or the operatives from these nations. And that would be Iran and Turkey and several countries within Central Asia and Caucasus, including Azerbaijan, because they also speak various dialects of Turkish language. They are Turkic root languages. And let me just say that I never planned working for the government. I never wanted to work for the government, not only here, but anywhere else in the world. I grew up skeptical of governments, big governments. My father was a known surgeon in Iran. He was taken in and tortured for the kinds of books he was reading and handing out to people. I went through a military coup in Turkey in 1981, implemented by NATO and the United States. And we went through all the martial laws and the curfew. So I have lived in many countries to have this pretty good, strong desire to stay away from the government. The only reason I accepted the job offer, and they basically called and begged me because they said, our country, our nation needs you, Ms. Edmonds. We have had this attack and we are still under attack. There may be more attacks. And with you, we get 3-4 languages covered, plus your background and your analytical skills. I have a bachelor's degree. I have 2 of them in criminal psychology and criminal justice. I also have a master's degree in public policy. So all those kind of were, I guess, attractive to them. And I couldn't say no, because I was just like any other Americans out there. Well, they're telling me this is my chance to serve my country, and really my country, because other countries I lived in, I was either born in them or I lived them because my parents went from one country to another country for my dad's work. They were not by choice my country. The United States, I came here in 1988. I decided, consciously made a decision to become a citizen. So this is my first and only country by country of choice. And I became a citizen by choice, not because I was born into it. So I said, sure. And I was pretty naive. I was very green. I was similar to many Americans that I get to see or hear from. I totally believe what I was given through my education in the United States, master's in public policy. I love the fact that I was living in a country with separation of powers and constitution, bill of rights, the system of checks and balances. Little I knew. I had no idea that these were illusions that were being marketed and sold to the public through the education, academics, and the mainstream media, and of course, Hollywood. So I was one of the believers. I was very green. I believed that they didn't exist only in theory, but that they, in fact, applied. Well, as soon as I started working at the FBI, I came across some major cover-ups on extremely important investigations, not by choice by the agents, but because of the higher-ups in the State Department and people within the CIA, basically hindering the investigations taken by the FBI. In addition to that, I also witnessed incredible level of waste, fraud, abuse, I mean, things that if they were to really put it out there, and it should be out there, and I'm sure many people have tried to put it out there, and it's out there, that what the government does with people's trust and the tax dollars that they are cutting and collecting every month from their paychecks. And to me, that was an eye-opener, not only the cover-ups, but how these agencies were ran. And being an outsider, I was working for them as a contractor and someone who has always believed in the free market and the efficiency. My husband and I, we've been married for 25 years. We have had our own business. It was surreal, the level of intentional waste, fraud, and abuse. And with the cover-ups and issues being significant, I tried to bring some of these issues to the attention of higher-ups within the FBI. Well, that was a major mistake because the problem actually was stemming from those higher-ups, the executive-level people. And that began a chain of reaction and retaliation. And then at that point, I said, well, based on what I studied, what I have a master's degree on, there are channels I can pursue. Yeah, I didn't go out there to media and leak documents. I believe there were appropriate channels, so it's my duty to take it to the Inspector General's office and have them look into these issues and do something about it. Well, the Inspector General's office for the FBI, DOJ, they work for the same bosses. So basically, you're going to the same people and asking them to investigate themselves. But hey, they said this is one of the so-called channels. I pursued it. That brought more retaliation. In fact, half a dozen or more agents stormed our house.
Here she's asked, what sort of information had she reported?
In some cases, there were significant, important facts related to counterintelligence investigations by the FBI that were stopped from being pursued via State Department and the CIA. Because the targets of those investigations actually had other working and operative relationship with individuals within the CIA and the State Department. So whether they were notorious criminals, let's say in movement of heroin into the United States from Afghanistan via Turkey and then Belgium, NATO's headquarters, and from there directly into the United States, or terrorism activities sponsored, strategically designed here in Chicago, in the United States, and then with the players being sent to areas in Central Asia, Caucasus, Middle East to execute terror attacks. These people didn't work for Al-Qaeda. They worked together with the CIA and a certain Pentagon unit. These were the issues that would not be within the scope of what the FBI agreed. And you could not investigate and do anything about really true investigation of 9/11 without linking and getting linked to players within the United States. And on top of that chain, dealing with the CIA operations and certain Pentagon, joint Pentagon NATO operations overseas that were being handled from the United States. I know it sounds complex. I have received more gag orders than any other person in the history of this country. They invoked the state secrets privilege during John Ashcroft's Justice Department twice in my case. The Justice Department retroactively classified all investigations conducted by the United States Congress in my case. And this is after the United States Congress went publicly on record and they said all my reports and allegations were confirmed by other documents and other witnesses. But the Justice Department said, okay, now they're retroactively classified, your results, the investigation results, and we impose gag order on you.
Here she's asked what the gag order prohibits her from saying.
In short, it means violating Constitution and separation of powers because you can't have the executive branch, the Justice Department, issue gag order via retroactive classification on the other branch, legislative branch, the United States Congress. They basically said, you investigated, you said this, you're going to destroy all these documents, we are collecting everything in your computer. You cannot even refer to Sybil Edmonds because under state secrets privilege, which they did via court, because I also went to court in this case, tried to get the case moving in court so I could bring in witnesses and expose all these massive cover-ups and the consequences of those cover-ups and for the public's right to know. So the information, the truth would come out. And none of these were justifiably classified. It was not about some ongoing investigations. It was not anything that in any way could have been considered classified. They didn't want the public to know because that would have caused outrage. It would have exposed government's own illegality. Well, with Congress, even though illegal, this retroactive classification and gag order, they abided by it. And from both parties, I am not allowed to discuss the fact that there has been an ongoing operation and that involves CIA, NATO, and a certain division within Pentagon that implements, creates terror events at home and abroad, whether it's in Central Asia, whether it's by using Chechens, by training and arming them and having them blow up a building inside Russia, whether it is training and directing another group to blow up a certain entity within Turkey, that these operations are not done via what they advertise to be entities such as Al-Qaeda, or in this case, I'm sure it is what they call ISIL or ISIS. When you look at it, these entities, like in 19, my counterintelligence investigations that I was working on with three FBI agents, and these were field level agents, they were good people, these guys. The problem was from the higher ups and the State Department, the CIA. In 1997, for example, we had counterintelligence recording by tapping certain embassies, let's say if it's Turkish embassies, from 1997 records, that had Ayman al-Zawahiri of Al-Qaeda with two very well-known State Department officials, including Mark Grossman, and Prince Bandar meeting in Azerbaijan, in Baku, in an embassy, and on how to bring certain, what they call terrorist groups from Pakistan and from Saudi Arabia into Turkey, give them fake passports and funnel them into the Balkans area. And there for them to have training camps established and opening up mosques, building mosques. Okay. The financing of it partly came from the United States directly, partly from the Saudi Arabia, but also the operation included utilizing the opium grown in Afghanistan region and then processed in Turkey. Turkey is a NATO member, NATO ally country. And then from Turkey being distributed and traveling through Belgium, United Kingdom, and also in the United States, you're looking at terror activities committed by the United States government. You're looking at illegal narcotic operations being actually directed and operated by the by entities within the United States government. And yet, the stories being sold to the public being that there are these boogeymen in Afghanistan and there are these boogeymen Islamists in Saudi Arabia, they are independent actors who have come up together and they are terrorists and they hate the way of life we have here in the United States. And lo and behold, they are attacking our interests around the world and in our country. It basically, everything that we had in the FBI contradicted the story being told from the government, by the government to the media, and by the media being sold to the American public. That would be the summarized version of what it involved. Well, that's why the gag orders, the state secrets privilege, in courts, they came before the judges, the Justice Department and FBI attorneys. And they said, even if she's right, she can't talk about those because everything she knows is classified at the highest level. In fact, we want you, judge, and this was Judge Reggie Walton initially, and then it went to the appellate court and to the Supreme Court, Tom. We want you to declare her birthplace, where I was born, her birth date, the languages she speaks, where she has gone to school, like university degrees, all classified. And the judge approved it. The judge said, and this is the exact sentence he said. He said, during these terror situations, who am I as a judge to disagree with the Justice Department and the FBI if they are telling me this will bolden terror and increase our terror, the threats of terror? Therefore, I'm going to grant. For us, my attorneys and I saying, how could you declare my birth date classified? If a police pulls me aside and says you were speeding, driver's license, please. What am I going to say? I can't hand you my driver's license because it contains my birth date. It is that Kafkaesque. But the fact that these Kafkaesque authoritarian police state requests from the courts sailed through the courts. So you had in federal courts, both at the appellate, later the Supreme Court level, for the judges to agree with it and saying, okay, yes, you can do that. Heck with the First Amendment. Heck with the due process. You can do that. The fact that the Congress can abide by an illegal gag order by the executive branch, well, that happened without any resistance from Senator Grassley, Senator Leahy. There were so many congressional people that they said, okay, if you order us, we'll do it. We're not going to argue with you. That tells you that neither our Bill of Rights nor these notions of checks and balances and the separation of powers really are at work or in practice. And if you were to challenge government's own criminality, whether it's criminal operations or covering up criminal operations, or it's fraud, waste, abuse with consequences borne by the American people, then there is no power above that government. And therefore, our Constitution Bill of Rights is conditional. It will get suspended if you are exposing government wrongdoing, because government is the ultimate power.
Here she's asked if she didn't just violate the gag order.
I'm violating the gag order right and left, especially in the past 6-7 years with my book. We got a special order. It's already on the internet. Justice Department saying that they blacked out because I had to submit my manuscript for my book, Classified Woman. It's a nonfiction. So because of the contract I had signed with the FBI Justice Department, I was obligated to submit that to them. They had 1 month to review it and black out anything that was sensitive or classified. Well, they sat on it for 6 months or so, Tom, and they blacked out everything. They told my attorney every single word in that book is classified. She can't publish it. We are not going to release her from this order. She can't publish it. First of all, I went to publishers and I said, because I know I did not put anything that was justifiably classified, because I know what is classified, what is not. And second, this is against Constitution and First Amendment. The publishers, all these major publishers, they said, unless FBI gave its blessing, they were not going to publish, because then the FBI was going to go after them. So I had to hire my own team, my own editor, my own book cover designer, and the fact checker, and get this book produced and self-publish it via Amazon. And this is after the written letter forbidding me, the government forbidding me from publishing. They didn't do anything. Maybe it was this bluff. Who's going to blink first? Maybe the government is so used to federal government by issuing the threat for people just backing off. They thought that was going to be the case. Maybe they thought if they were to take me to court, it was going to bring more publicity for the book and the case and the issue. We are not sure exactly the reason, but I guess they knew with the mainstream media under their control, so there won't be any publicity, any reviews of the book in anything mainstream as far as the media is concerned. It would go away. How many Americans are going to know about FBI whistleblower from 14 years ago or at the time 12 years ago? And maybe they were right. But regardless, I guess standing your ground and saying constitutionally they're wrong, you know, morally they're wrong, and I am not going to back off. And it's my right to publish it, and it's the public's right to read it. And I guess if enough Americans were to do that, whether they are government employees or whether they are just ordinary citizens, we wouldn't be in this position we are today. Unfortunately, that is not the case, because whether with the TSA abuses or with the NSA abuses or with the tortures and black sites, since really most people, they do not dare to stand up or challenge or do anything. We are seeing only the escalations of these police state practices, and things every day is getting worse.
And here she's asked that as an FBI translator, how she had access to all of this information.
Well, not only that my work involved in the FBI with these agents, one of or several important ongoing counterintelligence operations that dated back to 1996. And I performed analysis for them because they didn't have any analysts within the FBI or Justice Department who was both language specialist, knowing the language, plus having the political background of these involved nations or players, which my background did. But also after the whistleblower journey began for me, the retaliations, polygraph, confiscating my computers, the court cases, I formed my own National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, and I have about close to 200 whistleblowers from the FBI and the CIA and the DIA and all these intelligence law enforcement agencies. And also, I have worked with people who later retired from the FBI, on some of these issues, not only on my case, but on related cases as well, but also the political knowledge that comes with my background includes certain operations that were conducted, you know, directed by the United States, but conducted in places where I lived, including Turkey. And again, in many ways, it's different here in the United States. In a way, we are so isolated. When you are in Europe or in Middle East, you get to see many of these operations and policies actually in action. And even though in some of these, you know, all of these third world countries, everybody recognizes them as authoritarian, you know, under dictatorship, I consider, because having the experiences living in those countries, coming from living in those countries, and here for the past 28 years, that the situation of authoritarianism and police state practices is actually much worse here than it is in the worst dictatorship. And here's why. In those countries, there is no doubt in the minds of the public, okay, that they are living under dictatorship. I mean, you talked 99% of the people would tell you that they are living under authoritarian police states and that they have no rights and no democracy, all that. It's worse here because here with the illusion, you get most people, the majority still saying, yeah, things are not perfect, but we are far from being, you know, police state or fascism, etc. And that makes it that much more dangerous here because there is this denial here. There is, and as long as you have denial, you do not have any possibility, any chance for changing things, for throwing things away and building something new or any kind of standing up because there is that denial factor. In those countries, they have better chance, even though they get influenced by outside big countries, than we do here in the United States because people, they don't want to accept. They are in denial or they are just honestly naive like I used to be, saying that sure, there's some corruption here and there, but we are the best. There is no other country as free as we are. And we do have, and then we celebrate our 4th of July and we eat our hot dogs, we drink beer, we have the firework and we declare ourselves as a nation of free where the fact, where the reality is far from it. Thus, rendering us in a more precarious, dangerous situation than those third world countries with already publicly acknowledged authoritarian regimes.
And now here she's asked about how to get people to believe in what she's saying about who's actually sponsoring the terrorists.
They would say it is impossible. Again, it comes, again, thanks to the mainstream media, maybe resistance by the people to actually even delve into history and context. That is not something new. Operation Gladio began right after World War II, and it is not a conspiracy theory. If you were to go and type it, it was a NATO, US, and UK-ran operation that said, okay, in order to counter the communism and Soviet Union, okay, and what we're going to do is we're going to create these false flag terror events in Turkey. And if you go to the list, these are confirmed lists. CIA's FOIA after 40 years have already put this information out. You will see these terror incidents in Italy, okay, that was conducted by the U.S. NATO forces, and then that was blamed on some communist faction in Italy or the Soviet Union. You go and look at Bulgaria and you see what happened there. You will go and see in Turkey. So these false flag operations, they're already confirmed. So what happened, Tom, is after the fall of the Soviet Union, that operation started shifting starting in 1995. And that's the counterintelligence operations I was working with the FBI agents in this specific, very contained unit within FBI's Washington field office. Around 1995, 1996, the original Operation Gladio, which I refer to Gladio A, shifted to Gladio B. Now, instead of having creating these false synthetic terror events for the long-term objectives of the powers, the Western powers, and blaming it on the communism with the Soviet Union gone it was going to be blamed on the Islamists. And that was going to pave the way, not only our way into the Middle East, but mostly, and this is again something nobody wants to pay attention or even know about here in this country, with the main targets being Central Asia and Caucasus. Saudi Arabia oil is not going to be here in another 10, 15 years. The long-term objective has been Eurasia. It's been all these natural gas-rich, mineral-rich, oil-rich nations surrounding Russia. And whether you're looking at Kazakhstan or Turkmenistan or Azerbaijan. So, for example, let me give you a quick example to you. In 1997, because my counterintelligence unit also involved a lot of operatives and people from Turkey, Turkish being my primary main language, there was this mullah, this imam, this extremist Islamist guy named Fethullah Gulen, okay? Fethullah Gulen was preaching and wanting to bring Sharia law, and Turkey, even though they had elections, they were still, and they are still, under the military regime since the coup in 1981. So they decided to jail this guy. Mysteriously, Fethullah Gulen got into a Gulfstream jet, CIA-owned, in 1997, and he was brought into Washington, D.C., okay? And worked with the State Department and worked with the State Department's other puppet. And this is the guy they declared the United States State Department, the president in absentia of Turkestan, which is the Xinjiang region in China. So basically they said, this guy is a president. He's the Washington DC, but because the objectives also include Xinjiang area. And this is again, Turkic faction living in that portion of China, which sits on this very important pipeline for gas and oil. And by 1998, this man, this Imam Mullah from Turkey, Fethullah Gulen, began his NGO organization under moderate Islam here in Washington, D.C. and in Pennsylvania, okay? And right now, if he's still here, okay, if you go and put Fethullah Gulen NGO organization, it will give you the value of this organization in terms of financial power at $22+ billion. He owns the largest charter school groups in the United States. Well, our operatives from the CIA and State Department, under his name, with him, they began establishing more than 350 mosques in places like Azerbaijan and Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. Now, nobody knows where this guy is bringing his $22 billion. Nobody knows about the source of this, which goes to the heroin operation that is conducted by U.S. NATO via their proxy nation, Turkey, through Turkey. Now, those labs to process those poppies moved from Turkey to Azerbaijan. Currently, a lot of those labs are in Azerbaijan, and now they are able to do it in the source, which is Afghanistan, but they couldn't do that 15, 18 years ago. Fethullah Gulen is not a conspiracy theory. People can go. He's a Turkish mullah. He is worth $22 billion. He's the man. If they go and look at the number of mosques, by now it's about 380 plus mosques that we, together with Fethullah Gulen, we, the United States State Department and CIA, have established all over the Central Asia and Caucasus. Some of these mosques, their grounds were used for training Chechens, okay? And getting these Chechen fighters in mid-1990s into Balkan during our Balkan Wars. Some of these Chechen we used to send them into Russia to execute terror attacks. Well, some of these same Chechens now with ISIL, those same Chechens are being sent, have been sent into Syria and in Iraq. If you go and look at the roots of the Chechen terrorism, well, we did it with this mullah. We have been doing it, Mullah Fethullah Gulen, in all this region starting in mid-1990s under Operation Gladio B. And the documentation in terms of what this man has been doing, he's like an 82 years old man. He only went through third grade education. He has semi-Alzheimer, okay? He's sitting in this castle in Pennsylvania. It's a major castle, and the compound is protected by all these mercenaries and with helicopter security. And this man owns and operates the largest charter school chain in the United States of America. And he is, as far as the reach is concerned in terms of building mosques and training terrorist grounds, This man is much bigger than entire operations conducted by Saudi Arabia under our guidance. But nobody will talk about that in the U.S. mainstream media, even though the facts for it is out there for everyone to see.
And again, you were just listening to FBI translator and whistleblower Sybelle Edmonds. From an April 2016 interview on the Tom Woods radio show, she has written two books, Classified Woman and Lone Gladio. Her website is boilingfrogspost.com. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
And this is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg.
And later on, Indian trade unions plead for worldwide support to free 13 auto workers sentenced to life in prison.
But first, what's happening in South Sudan and the role of the United States? Professor Milton Alamadi examines the background of the ongoing conflict in South Sudan, which has created untold suffering, tens of thousands of deaths, and over a million displaced people forced out of their homes. Violence is escalating in South Sudan, and famine has been declared in parts of southern Sudan. As of 2016, estimates of victims of the war in South Sudan have already exceeded 100,000, and thousands more have been killed since that time. The United States High Commission for Refugees reported that 1 million refugees have been created since December 2013. Professor Alamadi talks about what underlies the conflict and what is the role of the U.S. and the U.N. The U.S. is the primary financial supporter of the government in South Sudan.
Professor Alamadi places a large part of the responsibility on General Museveni, dictator of the neighboring Uganda, who seeks a regional hegemony and has sent forces and military and in support of Salva Kiir. Uganda, he reports, is a super major ally of the United States and often does its bidding in regional conflicts. Military aid to Uganda, funded by the U.S. tax dollars, has been used against the civilians in South Sudan. Alamadi also says that Americans can play a critical role in ending the massacres since the U.S. provides $750 million annually to the Museveni regime.
Professor Milton Alamadi is a professor at John Jay, and he is the publisher of Black Star News. So let's listen to Professor Milton Alamadi, and then you're going to make sure to sign the petition that he wrote that appears in Black Star News. Let's listen.
Thank you. Greetings, sisters and brothers. When you see the conflict, not only in South Sudan, but in other countries, whether it's an African country, whether it's Syria, and you see the humanitarian catastrophe, you probably wonder, what can I do? Because sometimes these conflicts look like they're spontaneous, like they're always happening, so you're confused. Can we really do something effectively about it? So I'm here tonight with reference to South Sudan to say that, yes, indeed, we can play a critical role, because in South Sudan, as well as in many African countries, the United States exerts considerable influence. In fact, the predominant influence, particularly in South Sudan, the United States is the primary sponsor of the Ugandan government. Uganda receives about $750 million a year in U.S. taxpayer support, and about $170 million of that goes to the military. So why am I starting with Uganda?
and not South Sudan, because Uganda is the major player in South Sudan, has been the major player for many years now. And without dealing with Uganda's undue and negative and destructive influence in what is going on in South Sudan, we will not be able to resolve this problem. So this means we have to address the U.S. support for Uganda. Only the U.S. really can rein in the Ugandan regime, get it to change its destructive course in South Sudan. So let me give you some very brief background. South Sudan won its independence in 2011. It had been engaged in many decades of warfare against the central government in Khartoum, which did not have much positive contribution toward the southern part of the country. And that's why the South felt the urge to break away from the rest of Sudan. Ultimately, a deal was negotiated and South Sudan became an independent nation in 2011. And Salva Kiir became president and Riek Machar became vice president. They had led for many decades different units which ultimately had merged as the Sudanese People's Liberation Movement and Liberation Army. In 2013, a political crisis emerged between Salva Kiir and Riek Machar. Most of the regional African countries became involved in trying to resolve the situation. They wanted to mediate between the two when hostilities broke out. So Ethiopia, Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, and several countries, Sudan, became involved in negotiating a solution. But while Uganda was officially part of the mediators, Yoweri Museveni, the ruler of Uganda, for the last 31 years, was playing a very destructive role. He actually sent his army into South Sudan to support one side in this conflict, which was President Salva Kiir's side. This exacerbated the situation. Rather than a political crisis, now we have a full-fledged civil war with atrocities being committed by the government army as well as the armed supporters of Riek Machar, who himself was driven out of the country into exile. But a lot of pressure came to bear on both Salva Kiir and Riek Machar because of the humanitarian catastrophe that was being created by this conflict. Ultimately, a deal was arrived at. A peace agreement was signed. Salva Kiir signed very reluctantly, but he signed nonetheless. In fact, the U.S. is on the record as saying he would be sanctioned personally if he did not sign the deal to end the conflict. So he put certain conditions that he added unilaterally as an addendum before he signed. But he signed ultimately anyway in August 2015, and the same government was put back together. Riek Machar came back from exile and became the first vice president with Salva Kiir as president. This arrangement, the transitional government of national unity, lasted only until last year in July. Once again, Salva Kiir attacked his vice president's president and forces, and again drove him out of the country. And that is how we arrived at the calamity that we now face in South Sudan. And I believe Salva Kiir attacked because he knew that he could always rely on the military support of Uganda. Museveni would prefer to have Salva Kiir as the only person in charge of South Sudan. And that is the problem. So now the United Nations appointed a group of experts to study the situation, and they delivered a report to the Security Council in April. In this report, it makes clear Uganda's negative role in this conflict. It also blames Salva Kiir for being primarily responsible for the escalation beginning in July 2016. And it describes some of the most unimaginable atrocities that are being carried out against unarmed civilians, against women, against children, where even children have been dismembered and thrown in the rivers. How do you do this to other human beings? And that is how the refugee crisis has been created. Now we have 800,000 in Uganda, maybe about 2 million displaced domestically, and 60% of these are children. The report also makes it clear that there's only a political solution to this conflict, even though it makes clear that Salva Kiir is still trying to pursue a military solution. The report also makes clear that there cannot be a solution without bringing Riek Machar back into the equation. So obviously, you start thinking of what are some possible viable solutions. That's why, if some of you saw the article that I wrote in the Daily News, an op-ed, my proposal was that perhaps both Salva Kiir and Riek Machar should have their forces disarmed and bring a truly neutral international force to provide security in the country and to act as the police force and to also protect the country from Uganda, to make sure that Uganda's army would no longer be able to influence events in southern Sudan, while at the same time you're providing security for the South Sudanese, you're bringing a force that has no incentive to commit atrocities against the people of South Sudan, and that is why I made that suggestion. So the question that you may be asking yourself, why is Uganda playing such a destructive role in South Sudan? A number of reasons. Number one, the Ugandan dictator has been in power for 31 years. How has he been able to accomplish that? The United States provides Uganda with $750 million. The United States trains Uganda's army. The United States has a base, a military base in Uganda. That is how he's been able to survive for such a long time. And what does he do in return for the United States? He serves as the regional policeman. Just like Mobutu, the dictator of Zaire, which is now Democratic Republic of Congo, used to do in the 60s and 70s, a reliable U.S. agent in the region. So, for example, when the U.S. wanted African troops to be based in war-torn Somalia, try to prevent al-Shabaab from taking over the government there, Uganda was very happy to provide 10,000 soldiers, which it did. So in return, General Museveni gets a blank check. So what incentive does he have in crises in South Sudan? By creating turmoil in other countries, it deflects from his own repression within Uganda. So right now, even though there's a lot of political pressure in Uganda, when compared to South Sudan, you know, Uganda would appear almost like paradise. And he does that deliberately. This is not the first time. He's done it with neighboring Democratic Republic of the Congo, were invaded in 1997. That led to atrocities, multiple wars, and the Congo has lost an estimated anywhere from 6 to 10 million people as a result. And that was due to Uganda's invasion. So he creates regional turmoil to divert attention from his own domestic repression. But then there's a second critical issue which has emerged in South Sudan. South Sudan has oil. And that, I believe, is now playing a role as well in the crisis. There's been media reports that there's some shady companies based in Uganda, based in Kenya, and some based in Ethiopia that are brokering oil deals with Salva Kiir. And obviously Salva Kiir is desperate for financing to buy arms, so he's signing these oil deals. One reported deal was signed with a company called Aramco, which is supposedly owned by a Nigerian. And I say supposedly owned because a few years ago, Aramco signed an oil deal in Liberia, but then within a very short time, sold that concession to Chevron. Now, recently, Aramco signed a deal, reportedly, with Salva Kiir. Aramco promised $500 million. I don't know if that money was paid or not. But Aramco does not have the capacity to exploit oil. So I will not be surprised if Aramco's intention is to sell that concession to another company. Might it be Chevron? Might it be another U.S. company? Might it be other major oil company? Who knows? But that's the recent development. So now the question emerges, are oil interests also escalating and perpetrating this war by supporting Salva Kiir, thinking they can do business deals with him, even though they know quite clearly well, as the UN said, without bringing Riek Machar back into the equation, this conflict is just going to continue. And of course, the biggest victims, as we are aware, are the civilians, the women, the children, and the elderly. Let me add one other point on how diabolically clever this Ugandan dictator is. Now you have about 800,000 to 900,000 refugees from South Sudan being hosted in Uganda. But now, what is Museveni doing? He's trying to milk political and diplomatic capital out of this. So even though he was the primary arsonist, because when Uganda intervened in 2013 to support Salva Kiir, it was quite ruthless. So anyway, now you have the arsonist who exacerbated the crisis in South Sudan, wanting to be a diplomatic player now. So he has proposed, and the United Nations has agreed, to co-host a refugee solidarity conference in Uganda, co-hosted by dictator Museveni, and one of the guests is going to be the Secretary General of the United Nations. The same United Nations who discussed a report in April implicating Uganda in these atrocities. Now you're going to have the diplomatic image of the Secretary General of the UN, Antonio Guterres, standing on some podium with the arsonist in Uganda and talking about the good work that Museveni is doing by hosting the refugees from South Sudan, when he, in fact, is the one that lit the fire. And that is why I created a petition, change.org, and I invite everyone who wants to do something to go to that petition. It is addressed, Guterres, don't let Museveni use UN to politicize suffering of South Sudan refugees. I hope you read that petition. If you agree with it, I hope you do sign it as well. Thank you.
Sign the petition that Professor Milton Alamadi wrote that appears in Black Star News. Now to another most serious issue.
Free the Marudi workers! Workers' rights are human rights. Free the Marudi workers! Labor rights are not a crime. Free the Marudi workers!
Well, it always seems a bit contradictory to be in one of the most posh areas of the city who have come here to India House to be talking about freeing 13 Indian Maruti Suzuki auto workers. Why don't you tell us exactly what brings you here and the story of the 13 workers?
I had the great fortune of
being able to travel to India when I was working as a labor organizer. And I had learned of the story of the Maruti Suzuki auto workers from the industrial belt in Manesar, which is right outside of Delhi, from the industrial area of Manesar. In 2011, they began a very important, full and militant mobilization to organize their workforce, to create a union, to advocate for their rights to safer working conditions, better wages, and to demand that the government and the corporation comply with Indian law and give permanent status to contract labor in the factory. Struggle to unionize and to improve their conditions lasted for some time, and it helped to sort of ignite a new movement in the area for workers' rights as a whole, and it helped also to ignite nationwide support of their movement. And in July of 2012, there was an accident that occurred at the factory in which a manager was accidentally killed in circumstances that had to do with some confrontation between the workers and the management, in which were never independently investigated. After that took place, the company and the state, using the police force, went after thousands of workers, terminating thousands of workers, criminalizing and targeting and prosecuting a couple of hundred workers who were accused of having caused the death of this manager. And there was no evidence at all to link any of these workers to the death of the manager. And what happened instead was that the company had created a list of union leaders and active union members and said to the police force, these are the workers that are responsible for what happened. And some of the workers that were rounded up and detained were not even present at the factory at the time the incident took place. It was clear to many people that the targeting and rounding up of these workers and the use of violence against these workers and the subsequent prosecution was mainly a retaliation for their efforts to unionize, that they actually are entitled to under Indian law as well as international law. It's been about 3 years since the workers were first rounded up. Over 140 workers were finally given bail after 2 years of imprisonment, despite absolute lack of evidence against them. Other workers remained in prison, and the trial finally came to be after 4 years. 13 workers who were charged with the crime of murder were facing the death penalty. And people around the world and throughout India were quite concerned about what would happen. There were letters that were sent to Indian embassies around the world demanding that they save the lives of these workers and release them, because there's absolutely no evidence to sort of warrant these charges against them. On March 18th, we learned that the workers were not given the death penalty, thank God, but they were given life in prison. We see that the 13 being sentenced to life in prison is an absolute travesty, an absolute injustice. It exists because the government and the capitalist classes are trying to protect the profits of these companies, and those profits are undermined when workers organize and mobilize. We had a really, really good number of people in front of the Indian consulate today from unions like PSC CUNY and Unite Here, and lawyers, and we had students and here, not just because of their concern of these workers, but because they're also aware that the profits that come out of the manufacturing of these automobile plants in India also seep into the pockets of capitalists in the United States. Wall Street is invested in the companies that manufacture in India, and so we want to be able to have a consistent conversation as a global social justice community to say that we will not allow for the rule of law to be used to cater to the interests of the capitalist class and to allow for the repression of workers who have every right to stand up for themselves and for their communities. You know, and we want to just send a message to the Maruti workers and their families and all their supporters in India that we will continue to raise our voice in support of their struggle. We're inspired by their struggle to organize on a class basis and the way that they have been, as much as on a community basis. And I'm just so grateful that everybody came out here today. And I feel like there's a lot more that we can do. And this is not the first time that the Indian consulate is going to hear from us.
Can you tell us anything about the specific plant and where the Maruti workers unionized?
The plant is actually the largest auto manufacturing plant in India. And it was originally a national company that was privatized in the early 90s during the period of liberalization. And eventually, the Suzuki company became one of the largest owners of the company, hence the name being changed from Maruti to Maruti Suzuki. And in 2012, we had a delegation of lawyers and union organizers from the United States and from Japan and from European countries that went to do an investigation of what had occurred at the plant and what had occurred prior to the incident of July 2012. That was a delegation that was organized by the International Commission for Labor Rights. They published a report showing the types of conditions that the workers had to endure for a very long time, including a kind of speed up of the day-to-day production of automobiles that for many of us seemed to be inhuman, like how much they expected these workers to work within a few minutes' time, like how much they expected them to basically use their body. It was a very dehumanizing way that they were expected to sort of speed up their production of the Maruti Suzuki product. All other sorts of conditions that were jeopardizing the safety and the health of these workers. One of the reasons that people viewed the struggle of the Maruti workers and others like them to be so significant is that in their demands, they also made sure that the issue of contract labor was front and center. In many, many factories, not just in India, but around the world, but what we saw in the Indian automobile industry was that increasingly the workforces are becoming precarious, in that the workforce is either under temporary contract or in this really limbo apprentice status where they just sort of remain apprentices for like an indefinite period of time and never become permanent. And you start to see this pattern within the industries in which majority of the workforce has no permanency whatsoever. They're much more susceptible to that kind of exploitation in terms of wages, conditions. And when you do not have permanent status, it's much easier for you to be terminated, much easier for you to be a target of retaliation if you try to organize. And so it undermines the power of all workers when the majority of the workforce are temporary and have less power within the plant. And so the Maruti struggle was important in the way that it centered this question of contract labor. And I think that that's one of the reasons why, you know, the state and the companies saw that movement as being threatening. You know, it's important to realize that about this particular struggle because I think it's going to be reflected in many struggles that we see happening in the future around the world.
Whom we're speaking to?
My name is Suzanne Adeli, and I'm a global labor and human rights lawyer, and I'm with the National Lawyers Guild International Committee. I'm part of a very loose network of labor solidarity activists called the Global Worker Solidarity Network.
Can testify that she certainly is, and there's probably not a global struggle that she hasn't been part of, not to mention incredible work around Egypt and Palestine and so on. And so now the critical thing, what is it that we have to tell our listeners to do for the Maruti Suzuki work?
They can go on Facebook, look up the page for the Global Worker Solidarity Network, and there we will have more information about the case. They can also visit a blog that is run by the Provisional Working Committee of the Maruti Suzuki Workers Union. It's very easy to find. It's just called Maruti Suzuki Workers Union .wordpress.com, and they can find the blog and they can find the most recent message from the workers about what's taking place and how they can support them.
And what's our last chant here?
Free the Maruti workers! Free the Maruti workers! Free the Maruti workers!
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
I think it's a historic vote where we can all say we're equal.
I often find myself conflicted whether or not I should try to pass as straight. I talk with less emotion, at a lower pitch, and with a slightly different vocabulary. When I think about it, I'm reminded that this is literally what homophobia is.
For his distinguished contributions to music, Tippett was knighted in 1966 by Queen Elizabeth II.
When the calendar turned in 1991, 100,000 Americans were dead from AIDS, twice as many as had perished in Vietnam.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Chechnya's gay purge engulfs lesbians and trans people. A young man considers the queer in his ear, and how to survive a plague in many not-so-easy lessons. Those stories and a lot more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the weekend in July 15th, 2017. The horrors get more horrifying by the day in Chechnya, where an effort in the mostly Muslim region of Russia to exterminate LGBTQ people seemingly continues unabated. Hundreds of men suspected of being gay or bisexual have been arrested at work, in their homes, or on the streets since the purge began in April. They're taken to secret gay concentration camps and tortured until authorities are satisfied that they provided the names of all of their friends and acquaintances who could also be gay or bisexual. Six deaths were confirmed by the end of June, either during torture or in so-called honor killings at the hands of shamed fundamentalist Muslim family members. The Russian LGBT network has been helping gay and bisexual men escape the semi-autonomous Russian region since the pogrom began. A spokesperson said this week that lesbians and transgender people, or anyone perceived to be sexually or gender variant, could be targeted in Chechnya too. He said that lesbians are frequent victims of domestic violence as well as honor killings. The buck stops in any part of the Russian Federation with President Vladimir Putin. He assured both German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Emmanuel Macron in separate talks that he'd launch an investigation into the allegations of a gay purge in Chechnya. The Russian LGBT network lamented late last month, however, that Putin's minions have made sure that any such investigation goes nowhere.
In his most chilling comments today, Chechen President Ramzan Kadyrov dismissed questions this week about the gay genocide from a reporter for HBO's Real Sports in a segment about a wrestling league in Chechnya. Stroking his beard and smirking, he told reporter David Scott through an interpreter that, "We don't have those kinds of people here. To purify our blood, if there are any here, take them to Canada," he said. When pushed by Scott about the numerous reports and testimonies by tortured gay survivors, Kadyrov said, "They are devils. They are for sale. They are not people." Clearly unhappy with the line of questioning, he said, "God damn them for what they are accusing us of. They will have to answer to the Almighty for this." A number of officials from the European Union, the UK, and most of the Western world have publicly urged Russian President Vladimir Putin to put a stop to the purge. US President Donald Trump has been noticeably silent.
In better news for LGBTQ people and their allies, Malta's parliament voted almost unanimously on July 12th to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. Only one lawmaker voted no among the 67 MPs. Maltese Prime Minister Joseph Muscat fulfilled one of his re-election campaign promises by ushering the marriage equality bill through Parliament.
"I think it's a historic vote. It shows that our democracy and our society is maturing, has reached an unprecedented level of maturity, and it's a society where we can all say we're equal."
The tiny, traditionally conservative Roman Catholic island nation has become one of the most progressive in Europe under Muscat's leadership. Malta, home to about 430,000 people, only legally recognized same-gender couples with civil unions in 2014. This year, Malta became the first in Europe to outlaw so-called gay cure therapy. Lawmakers have also enacted pioneering reforms for transgender and intersex people. Government officials in the southern European country predict that same-gender couples could be walking down the aisle in as little as 3 months after several agencies revised documents and forms to conform to the new law's gender-neutral language. German lawmakers have also approved marriage equality legislation, and officials there are also in the process of formalizing procedures and documents. It's now a race to see which country will be the 23rd on the planet and which will be the 24th to host its first wedding of a lesbian or gay couple.
A gay retiree has won a landmark case in Britain's highest court to get equal pension benefits for his husband. The company that now 66-year-old John Walker worked for told him it would not pay out spousal pension benefits to his husband upon his death because his pension plan predated 2005 when Britain first legally recognized same-gender couples. All five judges at the Supreme Court, the nation's highest, overturned a 2015 Court of Appeal ruling against Walker. They concluded that Walker's company was using a legal loophole to deny the marital equality required, somewhat ironically, by the laws of the European Union, which Britain is preparing to leave. The British government has assured concerned activists that there will be no rollback of LGBTQ rights in a post-Brexit Britain. Walker's husband will now be entitled to his annual spousal pension benefits of close to £45,000, about $58,000. Until the High Court's July 12th ruling, it would have only been about £1,000 a year.
The Church of England also advanced equality this week. A motion approved at the denomination's synod in early July called for the government to outlaw the use of so-called gay conversion therapy that claims to make gay people straight. The Archbishop of York, the Most Reverend John Sintamu, is one of the Anglican Church's most senior officials. The world needs to hear us say that LGBT orientation and identity is not a crime, he told the BBC, adding that it's not a sickness, and LGBT orientation and identity is not a sin. The Church of England's governing body also voted to study the creation of special liturgies for transgender people to help them mark their transition. Chris Newland, the vicar of Lancaster Priory Church, said that, I hope that we can make a powerful statement that we believe trans people are cherished and loved by God who created them. But ministers are not allowed to celebrate the weddings of same-gender couples in their churches. The Church of England's ties to the global Anglican Communion make that problematic. Most of the Communion's increasingly dominant congregations in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, known as the Global South, are biblical conservatives that strongly oppose any rights for LGBTQ people, especially marriage equality.
A gay man in China has become the first in his country to win a lawsuit against the practitioners of so-called gay cure therapy. The man, identified only as Yu, endured medications and injections intended to change his sexual orientation for almost 3 weeks in a psychiatric hospital in central China's Henan province. The court ordered the hospital to publish an apology to the man in local newspapers and awarded Yu the equivalent of a few hundred U.S. dollars in compensation. While the decision is considered to be significant, its scope is also narrow. Yu's rights were violated, the court ruled, because his wife and her family had him admitted to the hospital against his will after he had filed for divorce, even though he was not a threat to himself or others.
Elsewhere, the governor of Indonesia's Aceh province vowed this week to put an end to public floggings. Aceh is a semi-autonomous province and governs under Sharia, or Islamic law, while the rest of Indonesia is legally secular. Governor Irwandi Yusuf, however, doesn't want to end the floggings. He now just wants to do them behind closed doors. Indonesian President Joko Widodo expressed concerns in recent meetings with Yusuf about the negative international publicity over the viral video canings in May of a young gay couple with 300 cheering onlookers in Aceh's public square. Widodo is said to be worried about its impact on foreign investments in Indonesia. Pink News reported that a recent study showed anti-LGBTQ bias is costing the world's most populous Muslim nation as much as $12 billion U.S. dollars every year. Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and other global advocacy groups have called on the Aceh government to end corporal punishment altogether. But officials there launched a special task force earlier this year to ferret out and punish sexual and gender-variant minorities in the province.
About 2,000 police officers prevented confrontations between a few hundred chanting fundamentalist Christian protesters and an estimated 10,000 LGBTQ people and their friends parading with pride under rainy skies in Seoul, South Korea on July 15th. Only 50 people participated in Seoul's first Pride March in 2000.
Several hundred people marched through the streets of Tallinn on July 8th in the first peaceful pride march in the Estonian capital in 10 years. The annual tradition ended in chaos in 2007 when ultranationalists and religious fundamentalists assaulted several pride marchers. Organizers said that 1,800 people took part in this year's resurrection. A handful of protesters along the parade route were kept at bay by security forces.
And finally, tens of thousands of revelers celebrated Pride at London's annual parade, also on July 8th. The British Parliament's Palace of Westminster was illuminated in rainbow colors at sunset to commemorate this year's 50th anniversary of passage of the Sexual Offences Act that decriminalized private consensual adult gay sex in the UK on July 27, 1967. Here in London, Mayor Sadiq Khan wrote on Twitter ahead of the march, "You are free to be who you want to be and love who you want to love."
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 15th, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
Hello, this is the actor Michael Emerson, Ben on Lost. It's not easy being one of the others, so if time travel or moving the island isn't an option and you're feeling sort of lost, try listening to Greg and Lucia on This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
Coming up later in the program, a thoughtful consideration of the voices we love to hate and hate to love.
I probably do have gay voice. But I'm not ashamed of it. It's just my natural voice, and something I unfortunately have begun to think critically of.
And a recent book that recalls the voices lost during the AIDS years.
In those days, the women's community, what we then call the lesbian and feminist community, was mostly separate from the gay male community. Understandably, gay men and lesbians had our differences.
But first, a historic gay voice with a classical accent.
British composer Sir Michael Tippett. Coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Michael Tippett composed all genres of classical music, including symphonies, string quartets, piano sonatas, and choral works. Ahead of his time, he wrote operas with homoerotic themes. Born in London in 1905, Tippett was initially seduced by the musical works of Beethoven. He graduated from the Royal College of Music and was music director at Morley College in London from 1940 to 1951. During World War II, he was a conscientious objector, which landed him in prison for 3 months. To brighten his time there, he organized and conducted the prison orchestra. For his distinguished contributions to music, Tippett was knighted in 1966 by Queen Elizabeth II. Upon his death in 1998, he was survived by Bill Bowen, his partner of 30 years. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, John DeBoer.
Follow your favorite international LGBT radio show on Twitter at TWO Radio, read our blog at twopodcast.blogspot.com, and check out our fan page at facebook.com/thiswayoutradio. There are also links to all three at thiswayout.org.
Everyone thinks that I'm a freak, the way I dress, the way I speak. I'm too thin, I hate my voice. I'd switch lives if I had the choice. I'll be tall and rich someday. Everything will go my way. Someday, someday.
Do I sound black to you? Am I bivocal? Keep guessing. While a young queer radio producer from Outcasting wonders whether he has gay voice.
This is Outcasting Overtime.
a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is heard online at outcastingmedia.org, on iTunes, and on more than 45 public radio stations affiliated with the Pacifica Radio Network. Hi, I'm Lauren, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Alex shares his experience of the balance between trying to sound heterosexual and trying to sound gay, and the internalized homophobia that comes with this.
I've been working on Outcasting for almost a year now. Of course, it's been thrilling to hear my voice on a polished radio production. But in listening to recordings of myself, I've been forced to confront my voice for the first time, not only my clarity and emphasis, but the actual quality and sound of my voice. To put it bluntly, I ask myself, do I have gay voice? Gay voice is the stereotyped, high-pitched, and emotive voice that television shows give to their gay male characters to separate them from their straight counterparts. It is an extension of the belief that gay men are more feminine than straight men. Often, gay characters are used as comic relief or as a punchline for a cheap laugh. When a character has a clearly identifiable gay voice, it helps the audience understand, but it does this at the expense of being offensive and inaccurate. This small, seemingly insignificant characteristic is a way to ostracize and exclude gay people on a superficial level. Outcasting is an LGBTQ radio program, so many of us are gay. I am too. To some extent, I do have a fear of having a gay voice. It doesn't come from a fear of being outed. I'm out to all my close friends and my family, the people I care about. So, I think that for me, the fear comes from somewhere else. I often find myself conflicted whether or not I should try to pass as straight. It's pretty simple to change your voice. When I try to sound straight, I talk with less emotion, at a lower pitch, and with a slightly different vocabulary. I'm not really sure if this works. When I think about it, I'm reminded that this is literally what homophobia is, a fear of being gay, being perceived as gay. Doing this gives me some security and control, but it doesn't sound like me. It emotionally and spiritually betrays my sense of self. On the other side of the spectrum of gay voiceness, there's the push to sound more gay. When I turn up my colloquialisms and my exclamations, my friends seem to react well. Being a quote-unquote stereotype makes me more recognizable and strangely more relatable. I like when people laugh when I throw down the shade, or when I become what is so familiar in media. I think it fulfills my subconscious need for attention, as well as my fear of being forgotten. But I'm not completely sure if people are laughing at me or with me. And again, it just isn't me. So, there's a thin line between the two, both fueled by my social desire to fit in. And to be fair, I probably do have gay voice. But I'm not ashamed of it. It's just my natural voice, and something I unfortunately have begun to think critically of. A more introspective way of considering, do I have gay voice, would be, is my voice an accurate representation of my character? And the answer is clearer to me now. I should try to sound like me, not someone else, not more gay or less gay. I should focus less on my voice and more on what I'm actually saying, because my intention and my words say far more than how I say it.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is heard online at outcastingmedia.org, on iTunes, and on more than 45 public radio stations around the country. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to the show. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Well, folks, we'll be back in a minute with more excitement right after this word.
Beer, 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 beer.
Hi.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis.
I'm Margaret Cho.
This is Edmund White.
Hi, I'm Kate Quinton.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin.
I'm Clive Barker.
This is Judy Shepherd.
Hello, this is Ian McKellen.
I'm Jerry Jewell.
I'm Stephen Fry.
I'm Harvey Milk.
Hi, this is Janice Ian.
My name's Robbie Rogers.
This is Essex Hemphill.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres.
I'm Tab Hunter.
I'm Billy Bean.
This is John Cameron Mitchell.
Hello, I'm Bruce Valanche.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson.
I'm Robbie Kaplan.
I'm Andrew Sullivan.
This is Augustine Burroughs.
I'm Barney Frank.
I'm Cleve Jones.
My name is Kate Kendall.
I'm Dan Savage.
Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens. And you've discovered
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
The international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
How dare they?
And those who love them.
You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
And that's the truth.
A recent book brings an era marked by death back to life for This Way Out queer life and lit commentator Janet Mason, with accompanying music by John Buchino.
There are thousands dying tonight. Some say they chose their own scripts. Blame them, shame them, drugs denied. The sickness, the hate, and the hope side by side by side.
Now and then comes that rare book that brings your life rushing back to you. How to Survive the Plague, the Inside Story of How Citizens and Science Tamed AIDS by David France, Knopf, 2016, is one such book. The book chronicles the AIDS epidemic from the early 1980s, when the mysterious gay cancer started appearing, to 1995, when hard-won advancements in research and pharmaceuticals made AIDS a virus that people lived with rather than a disease that people died from. It was an epidemic of massive proportions. As France writes, when the calendar turned to 1991, 100,000 Americans were dead from AIDS, twice as many as had perished in Vietnam. The book chronicles the scientific developments, the entwined politics, and medical breakthroughs in the AIDS epidemic. AIDS, Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndrome, is a chronic infectious condition that is caused by the underlying human immunodeficiency virus known as HIV. I came out in 1981, and while the devastation France writes about was not my world, it was very close to my experience. In those days, the women's community, what we then called the lesbian and feminist community, was mostly separate from the gay male community. Understandably, gay men and lesbians had our differences. But there was infighting in every group. Rebellion was in the air, and sometimes we took out our hostilities on each other. Still, gay men and lesbians were also allies and friends, something that is reflected in France's writing. I'll always remember the time my partner and I took a bus to Washington, D.C. with the guys from ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, an international activist group that is still in existence, from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. to protest for reproductive rights. The women then went to protest with ACT UP and AIDS-related protests. At that time, many gay men and lesbians were in the closet because we were vilified by society, and in danger of losing our employment, family, housings, and ultimately our lives. AIDS activism necessitated coming out of the closet. Hate crimes against us skyrocketed. How to Survive a Plague is told in stories, including the author's own story. This is apt because the gay rights movement was full of stories, and because of the epidemic, most of those stories were cut short. Almost every June, my partner and I would be part of the New York Pride Parade, and every year we would pause for an official moment to honor our dead. The silence was cavernous. This silence extended to entire communities. A gay male friend, amazed when his test came back negative, told me that most of his address book was crossed out. He would walk around Center City, Philadelphia, surrounded by the haunting places where his friends used to live. We were all so young then. When I turned the last page of How to Survive Plague, I concluded that this is a very well-done book about a history that is important in its own right. The plague years also represent an important part of the American experience. An understanding of this history is imperative to the future of the LGBT movement. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
There's a world in a bubble tonight. Some say we sit by as it rips. Silence, sanctions, action guides. The poison, the greed, and the love side by side by side. But the love survives.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week, Wenzel Jones and Sarah Sweeney, produced by Steve Pride, John DeBoer, produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and Janet Mason contributed program material, with special thanks to Outcasting's Lauren and Alex and executive producer Mark Sofis. Bobby Day and John Buchino performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and our listener donors for making this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 3BBB Ballarat, Victoria, WHYS Eau Claire, Wisconsin, KMUN Astoria, Oregon, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. When the Battle of Algiers hit the screens in 1966, it caused shockwaves around the world. The film recounted the struggle over the city in the mid-1950s by the Algerian National Liberation Front, or FLN, against the French colonial state. Powerfully, it documented the insurgency and its crushing by the French, a defeat that was ultimately on the path to victory by the FLN. The film was an Algerian-Italian production, directed by communist filmmaker Gillo Pontecorvo in collaboration with Sadi Yassev, a military commander of the FLN who appears in the film. It inspired national liberation struggles everywhere and had enormous impact on so-called third cinema coming out of the cultural ferment against colonialism. Much has been written about the making of the film, but scholar Sohail Dalatzai suggests that the afterlife of the Battle of Algiers helps illuminate our present in disturbing ways. Dalatzai, who joins me today, teaches in the departments of Film and Media Studies, African American Studies, and Global Middle East Studies at UC Irvine. He's the author of 50 Years of the Battle of Algiers, Past as Prologue, published by the University of Minnesota Press. So, Hale, let's start by talking about the context in which the film came to be. Can you remind our listeners of the wave of decolonization that swept the world and was accelerated by World War II?
I mean, that's a great question. I think, you know, to understand the Battle of Algiers as a film and its even contemporary relevance is to really situate it or think about it in the moment in which it emerged, which is that moment of decolonization that you're referring to. And I mean, it was a period of massive global upheaval, where, you know, the legacies of European colonialism, you know, direct European colonialism through direct rule and the French form of settler colonialisms and British indirect rule and the Belgians and the Congo, you know, that was being challenged across the world, throughout the continent of Africa, throughout Asia, including what we would now refer to as the Middle East. And of course, this coincides with the massive kind of Black liberation movements that were taking place after World War II as well, and I'm sure maybe we'll talk about. But in order to understand the film, you have to understand that context. And I know, and I talk about in the book, World War II is this really pivotal moment, and I think it's really important to position it and situate it in the context of World War II, because I think World War II gets framed, as I talk about in the book, in a couple of different the dominant way is that there was the British and the French and the United States, and they were fighting against the forces of fascism. So that, you know, as we're told, it was a war against fascism against freedom. You know, the Germans, the Italians, the Japanese represented kind of fascism and evil, and the British and the French and the United States represented the forces of freedom. And we're told about Hitler and Nazism and master race philosophy. But as I talk about in the book, Aimé Césaire, kind of Martinican anti-colonial thinker and poet, wrote this incredible book called Discourse on Colonialism. And in the book, he basically calls out the hypocrisies of the war, and in particular, the hypocrisies of the French and the British when it came to Nazism. Essentially, he says that, you know, you, the French and the British, have a Hitler inside you, right? That the only reason that the French and the British are asking us, their colonial subjects, to fight on the side, on their side against Hitler, is because Hitler is now doing to the French and the British what the British and French have been doing to the Third World for centuries, right? And that is to say that the British and French are also operating on the assumptions of master race philosophy, right? So this became like a really kind of complicated moment for the Third World in relationship to the European powers, because, like I said, you know, the dominant narrative around the war is that the British and the French won it. Well, no, their colonial subjects won the war. You know, there were a large number of colonial subjects who fought on the side of the British and French against Hitler. But what Césaire was pointing out was that central to this thing called modernity and the Enlightenment was also and also then fascism, which is an outgrowth of it, is colonialism, right? And that is to say that to the Third World, there was no difference between the French and the British and the Germans, right? And of course, we can look at it through the lens of Black soldiers who fought on the side of the United States, who, when they went to go fight in World War II, not only were they subject to all kinds of racism and degradation on the battlefront in Europe and the different theaters of war, but when they came back to the United States, lynching was a national sport, and they were still in a very segregated, Jim Crow, highly racially violent environment, right? So if the war was about ending master race philosophy, then why was it still enduring in the United States? And why, when it came to the French and the British after the war, did the colonies, so-called, not, you know, gain their freedom? So I kind of lay out this context and talk about this moment as very important, because while many French, while many Algerians, North Africans, West Africans did fight for the French, as did many, you know, South Asians, what are now Indian, Pakistan, Bangladesh, did fight for the British, they were given concessions. Part of this quid pro quo was, all right, you'll allow us to publish newspapers, you'll allow us to rally and form political parties and vote and gain our independence. In the case of the French, you know, and this is what I talk about in the book, there was a big massacre on May 1st in Sétif in Algeria in 1945, the very same day as VJ Day, where the Europeans are celebrating the victory. And the Algerians march saying, okay, we contributed to the war effort, we helped save France, but now we want our own freedom. If the war was about ending, if the war was about self-determination and democracy and saving the world for that, and we want ours. And what the French ended up doing was just massacring the Algerians in Sétif on May 1st, right? And over several days, estimates ranged up to 30,000 Algerians were massacred. And it was a kind of signal to the Third World that European colonization was going to continue and white supremacy was going to be maintained. So as a result of that, you know, and the ways in which the British tried to maintain their colonies and the French tried to maintain their colonies and the United States was trying to deepen and maintain racial segregation and white supremacy as the law of the land, you then had, as a result, throughout the Third World, a massive upsurge in anti-colonial struggle.
Was there something that also changed when the colonizers, and you said, although it's not well known in the United States, that World War II was fought extensively by the colonized in armies supporting Britain and France and so on. Did it change the dynamic when these people were asked to sacrifice, but also to take up arms in defense of the colonizing power?
It absolutely did. I mean, you know, and I don't want to suggest that after World War II is when the Global South, or what was referred to as the Third World, that's when it began. They began their rebellions. They were rebelling the moment the Europeans landed on their soil. If you look at Algeria. There's an iconic figure, Amir Abdelkader, who him and his army were fighting a guerrilla war against the French the moment the French arrived in Algeria. And throughout the Third World, throughout Africa, throughout Asia, there was a constant rebellion against these colonial forces. But what World War II did do was it changed the nature of the conversation, because now you had European powers pitting themselves against each other. And this is the important point, right? Hitler invaded Britain and France and bombed Britain and France because, as payback for World War I, he wanted what the British and French had, which was the colonies and the wealth that it produced, right? So the wars, World War I, but especially World War II, was about control over the non-white world, right? And who had access to those resources and who had control over these bodies and nations. So for the Third World, this became abundantly clear, and I think Cesar's argument and Cesar's, you know, claims and the way he would pointed out these hypocrisies rang true. Not that everybody read Cesar, but they felt it, they experienced it, they understood it. And so when the claims came about, started to become about save the world for democracy and freedom and self-determination, you know, it came to a point where after centuries of this, the Third World was like, well wait a minute, why doesn't that apply to us? If you're using it in this way, and then you're asking us to sacrifice our lives. So the way in which then, you know, the war like inaugurated or opened up a space for thinking about, you know, these questions, I think did change the dynamic in a fundamental way. And, you know, truth be told, Europe and the colonial powers were weakened because of Hitler and the Italians and the war. So as a result of those several different forces, the Third World had a little bit more space to move around. They had rhetorical and ideological and even an ethical levers to pull upon. That is to say, democracy, freedom, self-determination. But because of the weakening of the British and the French in particular, they were able to kind of like craft more space and expand their, you know, anti-colonial fights. And because of things like Sétif and the kind of crushing of different rebellions, you know, armed struggle came to be seen throughout the Third World as more and more necessary in the fight against the colonial powers, right? So that's why a figure like Fanon emerges and his book, The Wretched of the Earth. You know, it's not that Fanon came up with the idea first, but Fanon is capturing a particular spirit. And you know, while the Third World is going through this kind of upheaval, you know, there's a tremendous amount of solidarity. So there's the Bandung Conference in 1954, right, which is the Afro-Asian Conference in Bandung, Indonesia. Malcolm X talks about this in his famous Message to the Grassroots speech. There's the follow-up in Egypt of the conference in Cairo as a follow-up to Bandung. There's the 1961 meeting in Belgrade of the non-aligned movement, right? The Third World was like, look, we don't want to have to choose between the United States and the Soviet Union in this kind of Cold War politic. We want to determine our own freedom. And then, of course, there's the 1966 formation of the Tricontinental, which was a more militant kind of stand that formed in Cuba and Havana, that was like, you know, wanting to include black peoples in the United States and other black and brown and even Asian groups who were fighting for self-determination here. The Tricontinental was, you know, more militant in its advocacy of armed struggle as a tool for anti-imperial, for freedom in the anti-imperial struggle. So you had these kind of conventions and gatherings and conferences. You had artistic formations that emerged, whether it be the Lotus Project coming out of Lebanon, of Afro-Asian writers, OSPAL, the Organization of Solidarity with the Peoples of Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and Havana, which is political poster art. You had the Black Arts Movement here in the United States. As I talk about in the book, Third Cinema became the radical way of thinking about the role of film within forming a revolutionary consciousness. And so, but you also had like diplomatic channels opened up, training was being done across borders. You know, Nelson Mandela comes to FLN training camps in North Africa to train when he's fighting the apartheid regime in South Africa. You know, there's weapons are being exchanged and funded to different anti-imperial struggles. As I talk about in the book, you know, the Algerians in particular were very influenced by what Fidel Castro was doing. They saw themselves as the Cuba of Africa. They wanted to do what Castro was doing through Cuba in terms of like exporting kind of anti-imperial struggle. So Algeria, even before it got its own freedom, with the assistance of Frantz Fanon, they're going to places like Ghana, where Kwame Nkrumah was friendly to them, and they're making speeches and opening up diplomatic offices. And there's a whole host of kind of ways in which they're supporting different kind of anti-colonial struggles throughout the continent through diplomatic means, through funds, through weapons, and also art and culture became a big part of this conversation as well. So sure. This is something that was global in scope and also included, as I talk about in previous work, but a little bit in this book too, like Black freedom struggles here in the United States. You know, I talk about how Malcolm X is invoking the Algerian struggle and the Mau Mau and the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, the victory of the Vietnamese against the French in 1954. Robert Williams's work, the travel of several kind of Black artists and writers to Algeria or to Paris in support of the Algerians, James Baldwin included in that. And then, of course, the Black Panther Party, right, who opened up their first international office in Algiers, right? Eldridge Cleaver comes out of hiding with Kathleen Cleaver after they had fled to Cuba, and they appear in Algiers. And so Algiers had this kind of really iconic place within the third world imagination, and particularly for Black freedom struggles here in the United States. This was something that was global, it was interdependent, and it was a kind of wave of anti-colonial solidarity against Europe and the United States and their attempt to continue to control the majority of the non-white world.
And I want to ask you some more about that kind of tremendous political and cultural ferment that accompanied decolonization and the rise of this sort of third worldist revolutionary internationalism. And I should say that I'm speaking with Sohail Dolatzai. He is author of 50 Years of the Battle of Algiers, Past as Prologue. And I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So let's focus for a moment, though, on the history that leads up to Algeria becoming this touchstone for a certain kind of liberatory politics. And that is the history of French colonialism in Algeria. What sort of power was France? And tell us about the importance of Algeria to the French state, their reluctance to relinquish it in the wave of decolonization, the extent of the kind of brutality that they expended to try and hold on to Algeria, and what the nature of the rebellion was for Algeria's independence.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, and I'll do my best to try and answer it in a short period of time. I mean, of course, the French, you know, begin colonizing Algeria in 1830. So when the war formally ends, it's roughly 130 years of French colonialism in Algeria. And for the French, because of its proximity, because of Algeria's proximity to France, you know, just across the way, you know, Algeria became kind of central to the French state. I mean, of course, it obviously leads to, you know, in many ways, the undermining of the French state as the Algerian rebellion kicks off in 1954, right? The French have already experienced a defeat in what they called Indochina and Vietnam with the Dien Bien Phu. And so they've already experienced a defeat there. And they feel like the empire crumbling, as did the British, right? They felt that, like, this kind of, legacy of French Enlightenment ideals, and for the British, it was very much the same thing, was in decline, and they felt the ground under their feet, like, literally shifting. And so there was a crisis within both the French and the British kind of political culture about how do we maintain our control. And of course, Winston Churchill, through the Atlantic Charter with the United States and the formation of NATO, was centrally about the maintaining of the colonies. You know, the United States and the Marshall Plan was about trying to give the British and the French the resources to maintain their hold on their colonies. And I talk about that a little bit when I say that after World War II, when the Cold War emerges, the United States felt that, like, communism was a bigger threat to the Third World than was colonialism, right? That is to say, if the Third World got their freedom, the United States thought it would create a vacuum, and then communism would imprint itself and enter and have an influence in the Third World, and that was a threat to U.S. interests. So instead of having that possibly happen, the United States tried to maintain colonialism. So they funded the British and the French, and they themselves began to expand their influence into the Third World after World War II to maintain colonial relationships. They did not want the Third World to gain its freedom. So as I talk about, the Cold War, as we come to know it, is really a coded race war of the white world against the non-white world. I mean, it's not really talked about in those terms, but I think that's one way we have to look at it. But I say all that to say that, like, there was a tremendous amount of anxiety, in particular in France, over the loss of Algeria. So that all the way up until almost the late 90s, early 2000s, the French refused to call it a war, right? They didn't want to admit to it. It was akin to the trauma that the Vietnam War had on the national consciousness here in the United States, right? So there was a tremendous amount of political, economic, and military investment by the French into, you know, maintaining Algeria as a colony, right, of the French state. And, you know, it was called French Algeria. And there was a tremendous amount of struggle over what that would mean. And the French did a lot of different kinds of things in terms of legislation when they were trying to grant concessions. Do we give the Algerians a right to vote? Is it one-to-one? Is it one French vote to eight Algerian votes? Which Algerians are voting? Are the Muslims voting? Is it the Algerian Jews? Is it Berbers of the different communities? Like, and there was a whole debate within the kind of French political establishment over how to maintain this control over Algeria, but essentially, give some concessions to them so that we can kind of, like, take the steam out of the rebellion that they've experienced throughout their 130 years there. So, and in doing so, the French, you know, exacted an extremely heavy toll on the Algerians, so that not only in Algiers and the other bigger cities, but throughout the countryside, we're talking about massive displacement of Algerians. We're talking about the creation of detention camps, right? The seizing of land by the Algerians for French settlers to go in there and use the land for their purposes. We're talking about massive military bombardment and control over the Algerian population, extreme forms of violence. And I'm not even talking about the war yet from 1954 to 1962. I'm talking about the kinds of violence that were used to maintain French Algeria for the 130 years or 25 years right before the war ended, or the war started. So the French were extremely violent in their attempts to maintain their control over the Algerians. And, you know, I talk about this in the book a little bit because I think this is a part of the legacy of colonialism and just war more broadly that I don't think people necessarily account for. I think that we get caught up thinking about war as, and we get caught up in the kind of, you know, the spectacle of it. It's the bomb dropping. It's the drone. You know, it's the explosion. It's the shooting. But we're not really kind of clued into the other kind of violence that colonialism ushers in, which is a kind of, you know, what some scholars have called an epistemic violence, right? A violence to the very being of the native. This is what Fanon was getting at, right? So what does it mean to impose upon the Algerians that they have to speak the French language instead of Arabic, right? That they can't get married according to their own customs and traditions. They have to get married according to French law, right? That in schools, in public education, French history is being taught, not Algerian history, right? So what kind of damage does that do to the psyche? But also just what does extraction of resources do, and wealth, and the kind of decimation of Algerian social life? Like, what does colonialism do in those ways that I would argue is extremely violent, right? Not to mention the way in which enforced poverty is maintained, and that poverty is an extreme form of violence. So that, you know, we don't just see violence as a bomb dropping and casualties and death toll numbers, right? Which are significant, because the French, you know, over their course of their, you know, killed millions of Algerians during their time in Algeria. But there's other forms of violence that I think are important to consider. And I think this comes back in the film in particular, because one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, many people argue that the film was balanced and that it showed both sides of the conflict. And it showed, you know, the Algerians bombing the cafes where the French were, but it also showed the French and their torture and the French bombing of the Casbah. And people suggest that, you know, through the use of music, that there was a kind of equation between these two kinds of bombings, and that, you know, the film is really, you know, a meditation on, you know, the sickness of war, and that violence affects both sides. And while that is true, I do think it misses the point that we're talking about vastly uneven playing fields here between the French and the Algerians. So I find it difficult and ethically troubling to equate, right, Algerian resistance to French colonialism and brutality with the French's brutality against the Algerians and that violence, right? So that's to say, the Algerians were using violence to tell the French, get your boot off my neck. And the French were saying, we're going to use even more violence to keep our boot on your neck. And I don't think that those are equatable kinds of violence.
And I would suggest, and I think you do as well in your book, 50 Years of the Battle of Algiers, that the film itself, although it does show, as you say, the violence of the victims as well as the violence of the victimizers, clearly one of the things that gave the film the enormous power and resonance that it had that made the Battle of Algiers such an important political intervention and cultural expression of that period of revolutionary third worldism was that it clearly had its sympathies on the side of the Algerian people, as much as it presented both sides in the way you've described. Clearly there is, as with most things, a perspective that is being emphasized. And it's an interesting perspective because it's not the perspective of a protagonist per se, but of a people themselves.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is the power of the film. This is what made it so radical at the moment of its emergence, right? Is that, you know, here's a film that, you know, and I teach this in my film classes, and it's part of, this is what Third Cinema was trying to do, right? And it's the first time in a kind of, you know, very popular or public way that a film forced spectators to identify with the other, that is to say the non-European. Obviously, there were films shot in Algeria and North Africa throughout the kind of history of film, beginning in the 20s and 30s and 40s, and even all the way up until today, right? Like, the Third World has always been this kind of exotic backdrop to white anxiety or white neurosis or white people trying to resolve their issues, right? And we're always either the foil or just the kind of set piece to kind of give a kind of allure or exoticism to the film. But here was a film, The Battle of Algiers, that centered the Algerians within the narrative. They had linguistic dignity, right? They were able to speak their own language, right? They weren't being forced to speak French. And, you know, the film's power comes from its ability to have spectators identify with the Algerians and their resistance to the French. I mean, I think this is what, you know, is called subjectivity in some ways, right? So that even those really kind of, you know, kind of powerful scenes where the women are changing their clothes and they're going through the checkpoints, you're almost in some ways rooting for the women as they come through the checkpoints, right? You're rooting for the Algerians as a collective to overcome the forces of French colonial violence. And we can talk about, I think, later how this has shifted over in the post 9/11 moment, right? Because I think there's a different kind of reading that it gets done of the film. But when the film emerged, this is what made the film so powerful and why it became required viewing for the Black Panther Party, right? Why the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organ, was watching it, and why a whole host of other leftist groups, the Weathermen in the United States as well, Baader-Meinhof in Germany, and a whole host of other kinds of leftist radical militant groups were inspired and saw themselves as the Algerians, right? There was a kind of universal appeal by the oppressed throughout the world with the Algerians, because this was the first time in a beautifully done way that people were able to identify and see themselves through the non-European in the other, so to speak. And this is, I think, the power of what Third Cinema was trying to do. And I talk about in my book is that, you know, for Third Cinema and for the practitioners of Third Cinema, right, there was an intimate connection between film and the world outside of it. Right. It wasn't what Hollywood or First Cinema or even European art house cinema saw as the role of film. That is to say, it was either entertainment. Oh, let's just go watch a movie, escapism, or art house cinema that kind of got caught up in form and aesthetics and wasn't really about a kind of connection to the material world. Right. Third Cinema saw itself as intimately in a dynamic or dialectic, if you will, with the world outside. So that if you walked into a film like The Battle of Algiers and you began to identify with the oppressed on screen, that would then force you, once you stepped out of the theater, you would then have to see the world differently. Like, you would have to then potentially identify with the oppressed in the world. And what would that mean to your worldview if you were able to then identify with the oppressed, or at the very least, start to begin to question the dominant ideas that were existing in the world, right? So this is the kind of connection that I think Third Cinema, but in particular the Battle of Algiers, was making to the outside world. And I think it also helps that on a formal and aesthetic level, the Battle of Algiers, like, has this kind of documentary newsreel style to it, right? It could have shot in color, but it chose black and white. It uses handheld cameras, right? The fact that there's no professional actors in the film except the Colonel Mathieu. He was a theater actor coming out of Paris, right? He was the only professionally trained actor. Everybody else were everyday Algerians in the film, including Sadi Yassef, who plays himself, right?
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're speaking about the iconic film, The Battle of Algiers. I'm speaking with Sohail Dalatzai. He teaches in the Department of Film and Media Studies and African-American Studies and Global Middle Eastern Studies at UC Irvine. He's the author of Black Star Crescent Moon and 50 Years of the Battle of Algiers, past his prologue, which is published by the University of Minnesota Press. And we have a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So let me ask you about the actual making of the film, its genesis. Who made it and how was it made? Because that speaks to the, I think, resonance that the film ultimately had.
Yeah, absolutely. So the film was based upon the memoirs by Sadi Yassef. While he was the head of the FLN in the Casbah, the military commander of the FLN in the Casbah during the Battle of Algiers, that period of 1954 to 57 that the film covers. And as you see in the film, but also in real life, he was captured by the French, and he was one of the most wanted men within the kind of French Empire. And when they captured him while he was in prison, he wrote his memoirs, which were called Souvenirs of the Battle of Algiers. Once the war ended and, you know, the Algerians had some modicum of independence and freedom, he decided, you know, I want to make a film about this to kind of commemorate the Algerian struggle. So he decides to go to France and explore to see if there's some interest on the part of some French directors who, at this time, there's a kind of the French New Wave, and there's this kind of interesting kind of leftist cinema taking place in France. But no French director would touch the film, obviously, because this was still a huge issue within kind of France. And so he decides, well, let me go to Italy. Now, Italy at the time was the largest kind of film producer in Europe because of World War II. They had a kind of neorealist tradition. And Yosef goes to Italy to talk to several film directors. A couple of them have scheduling conflicts. And he ultimately kind of sits down with Guido Pontecorvo, who had done a film called Capo before. And when he sits down with Pontecorvo, he comes to find out that Pontecorvo himself, who was an Italian Marxist and part of the resistance in Italy against Mussolini, has already got a script about the Algerian war against the French for freedom. But Pontecorvo tells Yosef that, you know, there's interest on the part of Paul Newman in the film. For him, Paul Newman was going to play this journalist, and he was this American journalist who was going to kind of see the war from both sides. And for Yosef, this was like not what he wanted to do, to say the least. Yosef had a treatment, and Pontecorvo saw that the treatment he felt was maybe too celebratory of the FLN. So they agreed that instead of either of these two, that Pontecorvo and Salinas would come to Algiers and with Yosef, based on his memoirs, meet people who had just fought in the war, come live there for 6 months, and then come up with a new script. So that's exactly what happened. They come to Algiers, and they talk to people. They go to the locations. You know, they're doing their research, which includes reading Fanon's work, of course, Wretched of the Earth, because Fanon was part of the Algerian independence struggle and kind of worked at their newspaper, El Mujahid. And out of that, the film, a new script emerges. And this is significant, you know, so because, you know, what Saadi Yosef wanted to do was he didn't want a single protagonist in the film, right? He wanted it to be a film about the Algerian people. And as I talk about in the book, this is a fundamental challenge to, you know, typical cinematic or film form, right? Sure. Like, usually we're told, you know, the film should follow an individual that people can empathize or identify with. And it's an emphasis on the individual, right? And so what ultimately comes out of that, even in kind of grand historical epics or political films, is we end up then focusing on this kind of great man kind of version of history, right? That it's one man, Gandhi, or one man, King, that freed the Indians or freed Black people. And this is the narrative that gets imposed, that it's this great individual that led the people to the promised land, so to speak. And of course, that's fundamentally, as we know, if we understand social movements in history, not true, right? It's collectives that move history and that force change and that are the engines of radical social movements. And this is where Third Cinema was coming out of, and this is what Yosef was trying to suggest, is that, you know, we don't want to emphasize individuals in this film because it was a collective group of people who sacrificed a great deal to get to the place that we were in Algeria. So I think this is the value of seeing this kind of, you know, collective protagonist, or what was called a choral protagonist, in the Battle of Algiers. And so when they began shooting the film, of course, the film, as I mentioned, is you know, there's no professional actors in the film, right? Except for Colonel Mathieu. But everybody else was non-professional. They were everyday Algerians. In fact, they were people who had, many of them who had just fought in the war directly or who were experiencing the war, right? This, we're talking about now 1964, 65, where they're starting to kind of undergo production, right? So this is within 2 to 3 years after the war just ended. So the film chooses to shoot in black and white when it could have done it in color. The technology was available, right? The film is using non-professional actors. It's using everyday people. And not just everyday people who had actually fought in the war. So it's really heightening this sense of realism, right? It's shooting in actual locations where the wars were actually fought. The milk bar where the bomb went off, right? The street scenes where clashes happened, right? Places in the Casbah where there was actual confrontations with the French, right? So actual locations are being utilized, non-professional actors, the use of black and white. You have this voiceover that gets used as this kind of like journalistic communiques, You have these press conferences. You have Sadi Yassef, who plays essentially himself in the film as Jafar, right? And so all of this is really about kind of heightening this sense of realism in the film. And I think that's the tension that I think is really interesting, is that when the film showed in the United States, they had to put a disclaimer at the beginning that said not one foot of newsreel footage was used in the making of this film, basically saying that what you're watching isn't a documentary, it's a fiction film, right? But if you watch the film and you know about its history, you know, I think part of the tension is that while it is a fiction film, it's a narrativized form of the actual war, there's a tremendous amount of realism within it. It's shot on the actual locations and these non-professional actors. So I think that tension that the film walks between documentary and fiction is really interesting. And I think that tension is what gives the film a lot of its power.
And you've been speaking about, and we've been speaking in the hour about, the tremendous power that this film has, the tremendous influence that it had, situated as it was within the explosion of radical social movements globally for decolonization and liberation. But the film proved not just popular for those on the radical left and those who subscribe to third world liberation, but also to those who were of a decidedly different orientation, and that is the far right. It became a lesson for those who were interested in counterinsurgency. Can you tell us about that other history of the film, that other life of the film, the way it lived on in a very different way for a very different audience than it was intended?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I'm sure many of the listeners know, and if they don't, you know, the Pentagon screened the film in 2003, you know, after the invasion of Iraq and then, of course, Afghanistan, right? They wanted to use the film as this kind of way of thinking about how to crush an insurgency in Iraq and Afghanistan, right? But that wasn't the first time that this has happened. You know, when the film comes out, as I talk about in the book, right, the French school of counterinsurgency basically gets exported throughout the world. In fact, they're training U.S. soldiers and generals and military and in terms of the Vietnam War, right? Like, so Operation Phoenix, which was the U.S.'s attempt to kind of, quote-unquote, pacify Saigon, was all based upon the French model of counterinsurgency that they used in the Battle of Algiers, and they used the film as a training tool for the U.S. military in Vietnam. But it also got used in South America and the CIA-backed Operation Condor that was bringing together many of the countries, Brazil, Uruguay, Argentina, Chile, all the various countries in South America who were sharing intelligence to crush the kind of leftist uprisings that were happening. And the film was used as a training tool when many of these generals and military brass came to Washington, D.C., when they were training with what was called, what we all know as the School of the Assassins. The film was used as a training tool to help them understand how to do counterinsurgency work, right? Cordoning off areas, house-to-house sweeps, the use of torture. All of these things were being taught, and the film was the kind of visual accompaniment to all of that. So I talk about that in the book throughout the kind of legacy of the film over the last 50 years, you know, the way that it was pulled out of theaters, for example, in Uruguay after a record number of people went to watch the film, but because of the Tupamaros rebels that were kind of in the mountains and there was this kind of nascent uprising that was about to happen, the film is pulled out of the theaters in Uruguay. And then used by the Uruguayan government, again, as a training tool to crush the Tupamaros, right? I talked about in Mexico City the year before, you know, the massacre at Tlatelolco and the 68 Olympics. The film is showing at the Cine de las Americas, and it's got, again, record-selling audiences, but the film is pulled out of the theaters. And so it's banned in various countries, apartheid South Africa, and different parts of the world are banning the film. And in Brazil, it was banned because they felt that, like, the people who were victims of the Brazilian military forces in the favelas and whatnot would identify with the Algerians. So they didn't allow the film to come into the country. So the film has this kind of interesting kind of history, all the way up until, like, you know, even the IOF, the Israeli Offensive Forces, right? Like, that the way in which they use the film to kind of crush Palestinian self-determination, right? And I talk about how, for example, in the massacre in Jenin, you know, the film was used as a training tool, as a way of kind of crushing kind of Palestinian struggles in occupied Palestine. So when we talk about then the embrace of the film by the Pentagon in 2003, this is not new, right? The film has this kind of really interesting history where it's being embraced by leftist kind of radical groups and artists and intellectuals, but it's also being embraced by kind of right-wing military juntas and kind of military regimes like the U.S. Pentagon and the British, who are trying to maintain control in Northern Ireland. So the film has this kind of interesting duality to it. And I think this is what, to me, is one of the most troubling aspects of it in the post 9/11 context, is the way in which, you know, the film and its legacies are trying to be rewritten, right? So that the film for the Pentagon becomes a way of, the film becomes about how do you do counterinsurgency, as opposed to how do a people organize and try to become free, right? So the film has fundamentally shifted its kind of moral center, if you will. And after 9/11, of course, you know, when people watch the film, it becomes a little bit more complicated because, as I talk about in the book, you know, because of the war on terror.
What's striking is that not that the Pentagon screened it in 2003, because, as you say, there's a long history of the forces of repression, the far right, governments, the state, using the Battle of Algiers as a lesson tool for counterinsurgency. So in that sense, there's a continuity. But what is different is that when the Battle of Algiers was made, it was a film that, among other things, showed as sympathetic an armed struggle movement against a power where the people involved happened to be Muslims, whereas right. and was embraced universally for not because they were Muslims, but because they were fighting against colonial power. But now, obviously, the image of people who happen to be Muslims fighting back in an armed way is so charged, it immediately is something to be condemned. You know, this is a fearful sight. In a sense, without remembering the history that the film was produced in, if one were to watch it now through the lens of the present, you might end up with a very different notion of what the film was.
Absolutely. I mean, and this is the central point that I bring up in the book, that when the film came up, right, while the film was about, you know, incidentally, Muslims rebelling against the colonial power, it had a kind of universal appeal. So that, you know, like as we've talked about, a lot of different groups all over the world saw themselves in the Algerians. It was just about a people struggling to be free. But I think in the post 9/11 context, that has been narrowed and collapsed. So the film doesn't necessarily have that same kind of universal appeal. Now it's only about Muslims who are fighting back with armed struggle and political violence, right? And so it doesn't have the same kind of universal appeal that it had in the previous era. And of course, that's because the era of decolonization and third world liberation struggles was so kind of, you know, prominent, right? And there were coherent movements that had taken shape, right? But today, with a kind of absence around that, and then on top of that, with the kind of logic of the war on terror and how it's kind of racialized the figure of the Muslim, so that, as I suggest, right, the space for thinking about Muslim subjectivity, Muslim being, and even Muslim resistance has become so narrow that it's impossible for us to have a space now to look at the Battle of Algiers and see it with the same eyes that the film was intended to be seen with. That is to say, to give subjectivity and dignity to people who are resisting, who are also Muslim. And so it forecloses or collapses that space And I think as a result, then, when people watch the film today, they're looking at it through the eyes of the post 9/11 moment. And so the scenes of the women and the bombs in the bag, that's a very uncomfortable scene. I mean, it was back in the day as well. I'm not trying to say that it was just some sort of uncritical celebration. But I think today it's read through the lens of the post 9/11 moment. And that, since that space has been narrowed around Muslim being and Muslim subjectivity, it doesn't allow for a space to begin to understand what that might be about, right? And how do we think today about Muslim resistance, right? So that Muslim resistance of any kind today, whether it be by word, by pen, by camera, or by gun, is completely unfathomable. It's not something that can even be understood, because you're either with us, to quote George Bush, or you're with the terrorists. Right. And I think part of what I talk about in the book is even that language of terrorism is a very racially coded language. And that's central to why the film is being seen. I think it's viewed differently in today's context.
Do you have any sense of how the film is remembered now in Algeria, a country whose revolutionary past seems a distant memory? There has been a civil war. There's been a lot of brutal history since that initial euphoric period when this film came out.
I mean, I think, and that's a great question. And I think, you know, what we're talking about is the fact that the FLN has been in power for over 50 years, right? I think even there's a scene in the film on the rooftop where Ali Lapointe and Ben Amidi, the kind of the leader, are talking about, you know, the general strike and just the nature of revolutionary activity. And what Ben Amidi tells Ali Lapointe, essentially, and I'm paraphrasing, is, look, it's hard enough to start a revolution. It's even harder to win one. But the hardest part is what we do after, right? And I think this became the tragedy of the third world idea, right? That is to say that self-determination and decolonization were never allowed to fully happen, because through the IMF and the World Bank, the supporting of client states, the arming of opposition groups, the destruction of democratically elected processes, the assassination of people like Patrice Lumumba and Arbenz, the toppling of Mossadegh, right, that it kind of wreaked havoc throughout the third world, and that self-determination never really occurred, right? So that the reason why the Battle of Algiers continues to be relevant today is because the very forces, right, the very violent forces that made the film's creation a necessity are still with us today. That is to say, white supremacy is alive and well, racial capital is alive and well, exploitation of the global South is alive and well. And as long as those forces are still at play, the film will continue to be relevant. But in a place like Algeria specifically, because the FLN has been kind of in power for this long period of time, I think there is a kind of uneasiness as a result of that, right? And then, like, what did our freedom and this sacrifice really give us, right? Where are we now 50 years afterwards? And again, it's not just Algeria. This is the story of the third world writ large, right? There's a big question about how do we undo this legacy of colonialism and empire? Because we're still very much subject to these same forces.
We're out of time. I've been speaking with the author of 50 Years of the Battle of Algiers, Past as Prologue. That's published by the University of Minnesota Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Sohail Dalatzai teaches in the departments of Film and Media Studies, African American Studies, and Global Middle East Studies at UC Irvine, and he's also the author of Black Star, Crescent Moon. Sohail, thank you so much for your time today.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.